classical music.
What a miracle it is that we can still listen to music from so long ago.
Key Changes, Radio 3's essential history of classical music. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 11th of April. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. The four astronauts of the Artemis mission have safely returned to Earth after completing the first crewed voyage around the moon in more than half a century. Their Orion capsule splashed down in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California after nearly 10 days in space. This was how the astronauts' safe return was announced.
Splashdown confirmed at 7.07 p.m. Central Time, 5.07 p.m. Pacific Time. From the pages of Jules Verne to a modern-day mission to the moon, a new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete. Integrity's astronauts, back on Earth.
Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh, has been following the mission closely.
History's been made, and it's been made to perfection. This mission has so far been flawless. The tense moment was when the capsule entered the atmosphere. There were question marks about the heat shield, which didn't function properly during the first test flight of an uncrewed mission 3 years ago. So everyone was a bit worried. Would it work this time with four people on board? And it did.
Peace talks are due to take place in Pakistan this morning between Iran and the US to try to end 6 weeks of conflict. These are the most high-level bilateral talks between the two nations since 1979. Leading his team, Iran's parliamentary speaker said that Tehran was ready for a deal if the US granted Iran its rights. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Islamabad.
Even now, Iranian media are reporting that there are still preconditions that have to be met if the talks are going to happen. Most of all, there has to be a ceasefire in Lebanon as well. Israel has to stop attacking the positions of Hezbollah.
Sir Keir Starmer has shelved plans for the UK to transfer sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the US failed to give formal approval to the deal. Government officials insist that they're not entirely abandoning the agreement, but the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, said it belonged on the ash heap of history. Here's our political correspondent, Joe Pike.
In January, President Trump called the plan an act of total weakness. He has urged Sir Keir to scrap the deal, despite previously expressing support for the treaty. The deal would see the UK cede sovereignty of the territory to Mauritius and pay an average cost of £101 million a year to lease back a joint UK-US military base on the largest island. Ministers have run out of time to pass legislation before Parliament is dissolved in the coming weeks. A fresh Chagos bill is not expected to feature in the King's speech next month.
A 77-year-old British man has died after a bus carrying more than two dozen tourists crashed into a ravine in La Gomera in the Canary Islands. Six other people are in hospital. A head teachers' union is demanding that the government step in to help retired teachers who it says are waiting for thousands of pounds of delayed pension payments. The NAHT says members who ask to receive a lump sum are not getting it on time. The government says that it's monitoring performance of the scheme and addressing any emerging issues. Andrea Cassidy recently retired. She told Radio 4's Moneybox programme she was yet to receive her pension.
I've paid in a lot of money to my pension. It horrifies me that they're just ignoring me. There's no communication at all. I don't know what else to do. This month, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to pay my mortgage because I don't know if my pension will be through. I'm not a worrier, but I'm really worrying.
And you can hear more on that story on Moneybox at midday here on Radio 4 or on BBC Sounds. Golf and Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy is leading the Masters at Augusta by a record margin after the first two rounds of the tournament. The defending champion is 12 under par and six shots clear of his closest rival. He's trying to become only the fourth player to win back-to-back Masters titles. Well, that's the news and sport this morning. Now with the weather, here's Simon King.
Charles, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. We've got some pretty heavy rain around at the moment, some strong winds to go with it as well. But that wind is actually going to blow this rain eastward and clear away for many of us to bring sunny spells and showers. So let's start off in southwest England, Wales, the Midlands, northwest England, where we've got that rain at the moment moving its way gradually eastward. It'll push into the Midlands over the next hour or so, and then clearing away from western areas. And with that, there'll be some sunny spells developing before the cloud thickens again into the afternoon with frequent showers, some blustery winds, gusts up to 40 to 60 miles an hour, especially around the Irish Sea coasts, and temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. In southeast England, eastern and northeast England, a dry start, but that rain will move in from the west and it'll push through eastward quite quickly. So by lunchtime, most of that rain will have cleared. The cloud will also break up. There'll be some sunny spells developing. Then a bit more cloud with one or two showers, especially around northeast England. And again, quite blustery winds with temperatures of about 11 to 14 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, the overnight rain has already cleared away to the east. We've got some clear skies, a bit of a chilly start, but cloud increasing. And with that, we'll see quite a few passing showers throughout the day. Quite windy as well, with temperatures of 9 or 10 Celsius. And finally, for Scotland today, well, it's pretty wet at the moment. We've got a bit of mountain snow as well, some strong winds with gales in the northern and western Isles. Rain clearing to the east, sunny for a short time before the cloud increases again. Frequent showers coming in from the west, and highs of 7 to 10 Celsius.
Simon King, and we'll have more weather on Radio 4 at 3 minutes to 7. Now a look at the morning papers. Several of the front pages this morning focus on the warning from European airports that their jet fuel stocks could run dry within 3 weeks because of the Iran war. The Daily Telegraph says half-term holiday flights are at risk. It suggests airlines may not refund cancelled trips and instead only offer vouchers. The Guardian reports that the last Europe-bound cargo of jet fuel to have passed through the Strait of Hormuz before the war began is due to arrive in Copenhagen today. The Daily Mail declares that the UK is sitting on a goldmine of North Sea oil after prices reached a record high. It says the government should back new drilling in light of the Middle East conflict. Downing Street says it's bringing down average energy bills and supporting de-escalation in the Middle East. The Times leads on the government shelving its plan to cede sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the US withdrew its support. The paper says Downing Street will attempt to persuade President Trump to back it. It says the decision to drop the deal shows a further deterioration of relations with Mr. Trump. The Telegraph says senior ministers have raised concerns that Russian sailors could claim asylum in the UK if ships which are part of Moscow's shadow fleet are seized in British waters. The paper claims that Russia's tankers are staffed by mercenaries who could argue that they're at risk of persecution. The Royal Navy is yet to intercept any of the vessels. And finally, The Sun declares that a shoplifting epidemic has reached a new low after some Costa coffee shops hired bouncers to protect their food. The chain's owners have confirmed that 10 branches now have security staff. The paper says that some stores suffer thefts multiple times a day, declaring them the Costa del Crime. And that's a look at some of Saturday's newspapers. And it brings the time to just a shade before 8 minutes past six. Time now to join Martha Carney in the southern uplands of Scotland for this week's edition of Open Country.
This is amazing. I've just seen two eagles, golden eagles, circling high up in the mist above these hills, the Moffat Hills. I'm in a remote valley for Open Country in the Scottish Borders to find out about a dream to turn this landscape back to what it would have been 6,000 years ago, a valley filled with trees, filled with woodland.
We're walking through quite a lot of young hazel. Well, not so young, because we put them in on Millennium Day. And these hazels were an act of faith, because we grew them in our own gardens when we had the idea for this wildwood. And we didn't have a site. So when we got the site, they went in the ground.
Fee Martin Ogre was one of the founders of Carafran Wildwood.
And you see, they naturally coppice themselves. And they surprise quite a lot of people, because they say, oh, you've got a nice coppice. And we say, no. It's just what they do. It's fascinating that even naturalists don't know the natural habits of trees, because properly wild places are so few and far between. We're just coming up through the very last bit of that planting we did on Millennium Day. You see there's oaks and hazel and birch around us. put in by those first 100 people. We're approaching a circular dry stone wall structure, which in Scotland's called a cell. It's a sheep shelter, basically. Instead of being in woodland, we're standing on a terminal moraine and we're looking down into an extraordinary glaciated valley, U-shaped valley, that used to be completely barren. When I stood here in 1998, when we first looked at it, it was completely bitten to the quick by sheep and goats and cattle. There wasn't a tree to be seen. And now it's an emerging woodland, and parts of it look quite established woodland.
It's such a dramatic view, isn't it? I think I read it was called an ice-hewn glen. So it was made in the Ice Age, I suppose.
Absolutely. Scoured out in the Ice Age. But returning to something that it could have been. And we were guided in what to do here by a very fortunate thing. A wandering hillwalker found a piece of wood that he thought was interesting, took it home. It proved to be the oldest prehistoric hunting bow made of yew that had ever been found in Britain. And on the strength of that, the Museum of Scotland did some core sampling, and they looked at the pollen in this upland sample. It proved to be a very amazing sample. It's the best one they've got in the whole of the country. And you could see from all the different strata that around 6,000 years ago was maximum vegetation. There were probably more tree species here then than any other time. It was post-glacial. Things were getting going. Man hadn't intruded on that scene too much. And we thought, yes, we can use that pollen record to inform what we do here, the species that we're going to plant. And it's been extraordinarily useful resource, that.
Your project began on Millennium Day, so 26 years ago. And what would this valley have looked like then?
There was nothing here, no trees visible. There were, in fact, a scattering of them in the very deep ravines beside the burn, the little river. But you couldn't see any from here at all. So they cleared this area first of animals, and then the next year a few more. The idea being that we would keep the grass fairly short so that the new trees could go in comfortably and get away. It took us about 8 years to work around the valley. So as you look down, those at the far end are the youngest trees, and you can see they're measurably smaller. They're not just distant, they are younger. But we had done a lot of soil sampling, so we matched the trees to the soils, and that seems to have been extremely helpful. It's sort of oak-birch woodland that you would expect here, and birch being pioneer trees, you'll see them very well represented on that hillside.
I love the birch here, because you can see it's like purple smudges going
right down.
It's sort
of right
haze
down. Going,
it's
yes.
A haze, a purple
it
haze.
It is, it's great, isn't it? Yes. But we're very proud of this hillside, because it doesn't look planted, does it?
It looks like the trees have always been here.
It does, yes. And I think that's because we've got this match. You can't plant everywhere. You see the scree on that. There's open, rocky bits. But the natural scatter has been achieved by design, because we use commercial planters for this, and they are very used to planting in straight lines. But we showed them photographs of natural distributions, like petals fallen on a tarpaulin or raindrops or something, and said, look, they crump and then they space. Do it like that. And they did. And the result is we get people from the big agencies here saying, oh, you've got some nice regen over there. And we say, no, we planted every one of those trees. And they find it very difficult to believe. It's very thrilling and it's so important. And the bird life has absolutely burgeoned here.
What kind of bird life?
Well, everything from a mass of small woodland birds. First surveys, the baseline surveys, there were two woodland birds on this site, one chaffinch and one blackbird, as I remember. That was it. There were a few meadow pipits and the odd thing passing over. And the most recent acoustic survey has got up to 123 species.
That's quite a climb.
It's amazing.
But why do you personally care so much about wilderness, about wild things?
It struck me that there was very, very little woodland here. And when you actually looked at the stats, it was 0.03 semi-natural woodland in the whole of this area. I mean, that's zilch, really. And it's such a precious thing to be able to go for a walk in the woods. It just seems like something that needed to be rectified. There'll be another.
A fighter jet going right down the valley.
We took cuttings of honeysuckle and ivy for the ground flora that is so important at the foot of the trees.
Rosalind Grant Robertson is one of the trustees of the project.
These have all been started from little cuttings that people kept in their back gardens and then came out and planted.
I've heard about these and I've heard them described as like lianas, like the vines that you get in a tropical rainforest.
They're
part these are of our it. British versions of it.
Yes, absolutely. And it's what's often missing when the ground's been nibbled away. Obviously, there isn't a seed source here, for example, for those to regenerate naturally. Some plants will come up. We've found bluebells have suddenly started appearing again, and primroses and butterwort and all sorts of interesting things. But we did plant the climbers, I suppose you would call them.
Well, why is it important to have climbers?
Well, they're bird nesting sites, for one thing. They're nectar sources for all the insects early in the spring or during the summer when they flower. Ivy particularly is important for that because it's evergreen, shelter, and it has flowers in the winter when other plants are not going
to be
offering
nectar. Yes, I know
they're
very good for bees.
Yes, absolutely.
This sense of a landscape where there were human beings hunting, did that partly give you the idea of restoring the valley to what it was like all those thousands of years ago?
Yes, that was when man was hunting here. Probably there would have been the same wildwood that we hope that we're recreating, and he would have had animals walking through it, which will eventually come back as well. When our trees are big enough to support them, the animals will come back in. We will have mammals again here.
What kind of mammals will you have? I think there were lynx and wolves and bears here. Would you like them all back?
Go for the bears. Most definitely go for the bears. I think probably realistically, beaver is a possibility. Certainly this valley is asking for beaver to be in it, but that will probably come before lynx, I should imagine. Wolves, probably a bit more difficult.
Would you think about the idea of introducing or reintroducing lynx here?
It'll be for other people to decide that, but as a charity that supports that kind of environmental restoration, yes, we would support it as well. But you do that sort of thing in partnership with other people, landowners around you and farmers. And of course, in the end, it's basically a political decision, isn't it?
This landscape does take managing, doesn't it? It's not just a question of letting it go. You've planted the trees here, but what else are you doing to maintain it and help to nurture it for the future?
We're more or less finished with the main planting now, the ones that we get grants for, obviously. So we're withdrawing management. We're doing a lot still on the flora, trying to reintroduce flowers and ferns that belong here that may not have a seed source, so we would have to translocate them. Some of that has to be done with permissions and so on.
You prefer talking about ecological restoration to rewilding. What's the distinction?
Well, first of all, we've been doing ecological restoration since the millennium, and rewilding is a pretty new term, therefore, so we prefer to call it ecological restoration, which I think makes it very clear what we're doing. We're not putting a fence round and letting the weeds grow, and we're not putting a fence round and letting only one species survive. We're handing it back to nature, and we are waiting to see what nature wants to do here, not the other way round.
And if I came back here in 20 years' time, what would I see?
It would have spread further up the valley. I think we will get more mature trees and probably more dead wood. I'm rather hoping that we get more dead wood because it's slightly missing at the moment. That encourages insects and all kinds of fungi, for example, to come in. All I'm interested in is just seeing what nature has done and what it has found for its natural way of evolving.
Whenever you mention Carafran, people say, you must talk to Philip. And they mean Philip Ashmole, who's a zoologist and conservationist, who was the founder of the project along with his wife Myrtle. And he's 92 now, and I've come to his home near Peebles, which is set in 12 acres
of woodland and wetland.
It was a bit, you know, of a revelation, yes, you know, with 29th of May 1993, when I had the idea suddenly, after walking up those hills, coming across a tiny fragment of native woodland which survives on a cliff there, and I realised that actually there would be a possibility of bringing back native woodland to a bigger area in southern Scotland.
It was so interesting to see all the trees coming into life. I think people don't realise when they look around the hills and the borders and elsewhere that they would once have been forested. Absolutely. We take it for granted. We think that's what they look like, barren.
That's exactly what our thinking was. And we realised that this is a completely unnatural environment. And why couldn't we try and create a place, just one place in the south of Scotland, where there's something like what should have been here if humans hadn't got involved? That was the vision.
And what difference does it make to have a place where there isn't human intervention?
The main difference is that we remove the grazers, the domestic grazers. It had been grazed probably since about the 11th century AD.
So there's mainly sheep and goats?
Mainly sheep, but with feral goats, the sheep were easy to get rid of because we just had to negotiate that with the farmers. But the goats were an issue. The local people objected to the removal of the goats because they're very attractive animals. You can't plant tens of thousands of young trees in a place where there are wild goats, feral goats. We just had to bite the bullet. And it was a semi-military operation. We had to do it with the British Wild Goat Society. And he managed to find homes for our 25 or so goats.
And once you bring in the trees and bring in the woodland, other species come, don't they? I mean, you've done quite a lot of work around insects.
In press now, it's a very interesting moth story. You've got an overall increase in biodiversity, moth diversity, but you've also got changes in the availability of habitats for the moths, woodland specialists, open country specialists, less specialised species and so on. And the proportions of these different groups of moths are changing statistically over the years. You know, people want to know what does rewilding produce, actually. What are the results of rewilding in formal terms? So the moths are really super. And the birds are very good too.
So you've protected the wildwood, you've protected Carafran from the sheep and the goats. Do you need to protect it from people as well?
I mean, my wife Myrtle, she was always insistent that we were doing this for nature and not for people. But that doesn't mean that people don't get a benefit from it. And now it's very heavily used by people and in particular students. I mean, the Exeter group, they come every year. So do half a dozen other universities. Bangor come up very regularly with a lot of people. And so we have this lovely feeling that we're influencing seriously quite a large proportion of the future land managers in Britain, you know, because they come from all over. And that is important.
At the outset, it must have seemed an almost impossible project to get done. If people are thinking about this in their own part of the world, what's your advice for them? How to do something like this?
Not easy to predict, because we were unusual, probably, in being a non-institutional group trying to do a big ecological, ambitious ecological project. We had to be sure that people didn't write us off as an idealistic, non-feet-on-the-ground group who could be ignored. So we made a quite explicit and ruthless attempt to gain credibility. And so we ran a big conference in 1997, and we got, you know, a lot of heavyweights to come and talk, but we also got the grassroots. We asked for people to give us £250 or £500 to become founders of Carafran Wildwood. And we've now got very nearly 1,000 people. We've effectively got 1,000 people.
An early form of crowdfunding.
Yes, of course it's crowdfunding. Yes, that's exactly what we realised.
Well, it's been really delightful, wonderful to hear about how you brought all of this into being. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
The whole idea of creating a wildwood may have begun back at Carafran, but a bit like the trees themselves, the dream
has spread. This burn, Pretty Little Mountain River, is trickling down towards a large reservoir. It's part of land bought by the Borders Forest Trust next to Carafran to create what they call the wild heart of southern Scotland. In fact, the whole shape of the land is a bit like a heart. So this is Tallaght Reservoir and Gameshope Valley. Nicola Hunt is head of land management here.
We're just getting through the gate, which we've got to keep the livestock out of our sight here at Tallaght and Gameshope.
Yes, I can see the Tallaght Reservoir and Gameshope. And this links, doesn't it, into Carafran, and that's a really important part of what you're doing
here. Indeed, indeed. This sits over the watershed from Carafran. So Carafran feeds down into the Annanwater River, whereas this feeds into the Tweed. So back to back, and we're looking to connect. Well, we've connected the sites up and we're planting montane scrub over the high ground in between the two sites.
So just explain what montane scrub is.
So montane scrubs are really rare habitat which used to exist on the high tops of Scottish hills and down into England as well, but it's highly palatable. And so over centuries it's been grazed off. So it's little miniature willows, little miniature dwarf birch used to exist high up on the tops. Then they got munched away, so we're looking to restore these habitats that have been lost from our hilltops.
It's funny, since I learnt about the way that the hills were covered in scrub, were covered in trees, when I look at the hills which don't have that, they do look quite bare, don't they? They look quite desolate.
Yeah, there's been a big change in our environment over the years. We used to have lots and lots of trees covering our landscape, lots of native trees. Then we started using the land more, and in the process of that we lost trees and we grazed the ground with sheep, so that prevented the regeneration of more trees coming back into the landscape. And here in the south of Scotland, where we are, we've got one of the lowest covers of native woodland in Scotland. We've got plenty of spruce plantations, but we've hardly got any native woodlands. We've got little trees clinging onto hillsides, and that's why what we're doing is so important in terms of bringing the native woodland back to this part of southern Scotland.
And why do you think it matters to have native woodland as opposed to conifers?
So the native woodland that we're planting is a rich mix of species. There's alders, birch, oaks, hazels, hawthorns, all different sizes, all different seed types that will support a myriad of different species, whereas commercial conifer plantations grown single species monoculture a lot of the time, and it grows very densely, so there's not much space for woodland flora and fauna to exist amongst it. So by contrast, the native woodland hosts many more species, so a much better community and habitat to be creating for wildlife.
But the conifers are a better cash crop, aren't they?
They are a better cash crop, and you know, we do need timber, so I think there's space in our landscape for both. You know, we need to be growing timber here and reduce our reliance on importation, but we also need to have nature back in our environment. And also for climate change, you know, the native woodlands are here in perpetuity. You're never sure quite where the conifers are going to wind up, so the carbon can be released back into the atmosphere. But here, where we're planting the trees, they're here for the long term, so they will be sequestering carbon and providing that long-term habitat for wildlife as well.
Let's carry on our walk beside the edge of the burn.
So here we are at the planting spot. Have you planted trees before?
I have, a very long time ago. I planted one.
So do you want a demo before?
I want to definitely want a demo.
That's good. So first thing to do is you always want to make sure you've got a nice, clear planting spot, because you don't want the young tree to be competing with tall grasses next to it or any other vegetation. So we'll just scrape off the top vegetation. You see lovely brown soils here. So these trees should be very nice and happy. Stick it in the ground, turn it around, give it a bit of a wiggle, and that creates a hole. Pop that in, you firm it in, get the soil around the top of the collar of the tree. So out here, we have an awful lot of voles that run around in the grass and vegetation here, and they will happily ring bark trees if they get hungry enough.
And that'll kill it, won't it?
That will kill it. We've tried to move away from plastic.
I was going to ask you about that, because otherwise you end up with a landscape littered with the plastic.
Yes, it's littered with plastic, but also we just wanted a product which is not as reliant on the petrochemical industry as well. So do you want to give it a shot then?
Definitely, definitely.
Great. An alder or a birch?
I think a birch.
Okay, okay.
A downy birch, is that the right
name? A downy birch, that's right. So I'll give you your protector, and I'll give you a cane, and some kind of a sprint over there, so you might want to watch not get that all over you. You think you're just standing in it.
Oh, yeah. Otter poo.
Yeah,
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I've trodden it anyway.
Yeah, well, you get to smell it later and do the identification.
Right. So just...
So what you might want to do is just give it a bit of a scree first to remove that vegetation.
To take off the moss.
Yeah, and then you can see how deep the hole is. So if you kind of, like, imagine you were paddling.
So I'm not stabbing myself.
So you're not stabbing.
I'm quite clumsy, so that's highly possible. Yeah, I think
that's... I think that's good. So now you get to, if you heel it in with your feet, you'll get a really good contact all round about it.
Okay. Right, do you think I'm ready for the tug test?
Yeah, I think you might be,
Yeah.
So this is one of about 300,000 trees that are planted across this site, so...
And then put on... Hopefully the voles won't get it now.
Indeed.
So that's very satisfying. So I'll come back in here in, what, 20 years?
Well, the trees that you see around about us here, they are about 12 years old now, 8 to 10 feet.
There must be something so satisfying to be able to see the results of your work like this.
It is. It's transformational, this job. You know, you go out and you've got bare valleys and then you plant trees. It does take a while for you to begin to actually see the trees from a distance. But now you begin to see canopy closure as the trees get up and the branches intertwine. You start to hear the bird song just a little bit to start off with. And then as the woodland matures, it gets louder and louder. As you go through, you see lots of woodland plants beginning to come in as well, and then all the invertebrates that use those as well. We were walking around here earlier and nearly stood in a big frog, so there's lots of amphibians on site as well. So it's lovely having a space for nature to thrive.
Well, I can honestly say that this place is really inspirational. The idea that such a small group of volunteers can completely transform a landscape and make the wild heart of southern Scotland beat again.
Nice to hear a good news story. Open Country was presented by Martha Carney. It's a BBC Audio Bristol production, and the producer was Mary Ward-Lowry. Now, it may seem a little early in the year, but there have already been several wildfires around the country in the past week. In just a moment, Farming Today this week, we'll be hearing about the aftermath of last year's fires and about the prospects for fires in the year ahead. That's next, and then at 7 o'clock, Today is presented this morning by Justin Webb and Sean Farrington. Looking further ahead still, we've got a new series of moving pictures starting on Tuesday.
It's quite mathematical almost, the way it's been worked out.
Lose yourself in three great masterpieces.
The man staring out at us is pretty imperious looking.
Get as close to the brushstrokes as the artists who made them.
It's like a tiny little colourful bobbin going off on the vellum.
And discover new details in paintings by Nicholas Hilliard, Mary Cassatt and Jan van Eyck.
It's a signature in the manner of graffiti.
The new series of Moving Pictures, with me, Cathy Fitzgerald, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday afternoon at 4.
Now, Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. In today's programme, as wildfire season begins, we hear from a farmer recovering after a moorland blaze last year.
It's new life, isn't it? It's renewing, so, everything seems to be going pretty well.
And as the UK's bioethanol plant reopens with government help, we ask what that means for farmers.
We are very keen to support the local farmers, and we do our best to make sure we take a fair amount, if not a majority of our grains from local suppliers.
More on that later. Let's start, though, with the fields of golden yellow that you may have noticed glinting in the sunshine earlier this week. It's oilseed rape, grown to produce cooking oil. And this year, you'll be seeing a bit more of it. Why? Well, to explain, Howard Shannon went to see Duncan Farrington, who grows, presses and bottles his own rapeseed oil on the Bedfordshire-Northamptonshire border.
What started out as a small farm diversification to help a medium-sized family farm to generate extra income has grown beyond all measures. We're 21 years old now as a business, so we only now produce about 10% of our rapeseed needs. So we buy the rest in from other farmers around the area. But on our farm, we've got about 40 hectares of rapeseed this year.
How are you feeling about the market this next growing year?
We just carry on, and the rape has now had all of its fertiliser for this year. If we were buying fertiliser today, it wouldn't be so healthy, and this is because what's going on in the Middle East. So the price of fertiliser is skyrocketing, as is the price of diesel and other inputs. But by the time we start looking at next year's crop from August onwards, hopefully, fingers crossed, things have eased off a bit and the price hopefully will have come down again.
Well, Duncan and I joined by farm manager Stuart Tabernor. Stuart, is rapeseed a tough crop to grow?
I wouldn't say it's an easy crop to grow. We direct drill pretty much everything, so we need a shorter window of time to actually get the crops established. And with the dry last year, the rain did come at just the right time for this. I mean, we planted our rape just after the August bank holiday, and it's come really well, and it has grown really well all through the winter.
Now, Stuart, we're on the edge of a field now looking at your crop. Visually, to me, it looks very healthy. It's very vibrant. It's very yellow. The plants are about 80 centimetres tall, maybe, or 60 centimetres tall. They seem to be doing well. Are you happy with how it's coming together this year?
Yeah, I'm very happy with how it's growing this year. I've been saying to Duncan all spring that I'm a bit of a loss because I've never actually grown rape that's looked this good this time of year, because it's normally been taken out by the flea beetle or the pigeon. So I'm really, really hopeful for a good harvest.
Now, Duncan, do you know how many other farmers are growing rape? How big is the market in the UK for it?
Well, last year, 2024-2025, was the lowest rape crop in the UK for about 40 years. Because of, as Stuart says, the flea beetle issue was a huge, it was a real challenge for growers to, you know, spend their money and effort trying to get a crop established and see it all eaten away. And then if it wasn't the flea beetle, the pigeons were eating it. So a lot of people went out away from growing rapeseed. But this year, so for 2026 harvest, farmers are coming back in to growing the crop. And it's a brilliant year, as Stuart said. You know, it's had an easy autumn, a reasonable winter, and the crops are going into the spring looking well. And from we're on the top of a hill here and looking around, you can see other fields from our neighbours. So there are more farmers growing rapeseed, so we're coming back from that low level of the 2024 and 2025 years.
Duncan Farrington there. Well, as he said, that oilseed rape was planted last year, but all this week on our sister programme, Farming Today, we've been talking about spring planting, finding out about the crops currently being drilled, ready for harvest later in the year. First, paludiculture. It's a great sounding word, and it means farming on wetlands, like bogs or rewetted peatlands. The UK's peatlands store more than 3 billion tonnes of carbon, and keeping peat wet locks it in the earth, so it's not lost back to the atmosphere, contributing to global warming. But historically, a lot of lowland peatland has been drained for agriculture, and while that's good for producing food, the dry peat emits carbon. Government figures suggest that in 2020, around 3% of England's greenhouse gas emissions were from drained agricultural peatland. Well, there are a lot of projects taking place across the UK to re-wet peatland, and the hope is that paludiculture will mean those areas can also produce food. The Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, has recently awarded grants to 12 projects which are looking at growing plants in lowland peat. Kaz Graham went along to one of these projects to see their newest crop going into the ground.
First things first, the wind speed looks all right for the operation. We may expect some military low-flying in the area, but I notified the relevant authorities.
That's drone operator Yuri Adam. Now, you don't usually need to check with the Civil Aviation Authority before planting out a field, but this is not a conventional field, it's not a conventional crop, and it is not a conventional planting method. We're on the low-lying peatland of the Holker Estate on a glorious morning. I'm with David Harvey, the man behind developing the paludiculture here. David, what are you planting in this field and why will you be using a drone to do it?
So this morning we're planting a crop called Typha latifolia, which is bulrush ultimately. We are using a drone because, as you'll notice and see from the field, It is flooded.
We are up to our ankles in water, aren't we? Yeah. Actually, and mud.
Yeah, so you wouldn't normally put a tractor through this field, whereas the drone obviously doesn't have the same challenges.
And this is all part of your paludiculture project. Tell me about it. What are you doing here?
Yeah, so initially we went out to research the viability of growing paludiculture crops. We championed them down to six. We have taken typha forward and would like to plant that as a trial crop to see if we can grow that on our farm.
And explain exactly what typha is.
It's a bulrush crop. It will grow to about 6 foot tall. There'll be a seed head on the top of it that we'll be able to harvest and use in the textile industry, leaving us the biomass of the crop for a second bite of the cherry. The field has always been a challenging field. It's peatland. We have grown arable crops on it in the past. The estate is looking to see if there's a better use for the field.
Well, we are waiting for Yuri to get his drone set up so that he can start the planting process. The drone has been brought along by Austin Shepherd from Ponder. And Ponder is a company that creates textiles from fibres that come from regenerative farming practices, things like paludiculture. And this crop is going to come to you when it's finished, these huge bulrushes, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. We take the seed heads and we turn it into insulation for garments in the fashion industry.
What kinds of things?
All sorts. The gilet I'm wearing today through to more experimental pieces that will end up on the catwalk. Everything, really.
And here we are. We're standing in 6 inches of water. How on earth do you harvest this crop?
Well, that's been a challenge for us, but thankfully with working with various partners, we've developed something we call the Frog. It's a low-impact harvester with a 4-metre header on it that's got less ground pressure than a human foot, raises up 1.5 metres and only takes the seed head in a very uninvasive way.
So it's ready to go, guys.
Wow, this drone, it's probably about 3 foot off the ground. It's got 4 big kind of like helicopter blades, so it spans an area of about 6-8 foot, something like that. And it's got a white plastic hopper underneath, and that will be where the seed pellets will drop out. Quite an impressive drone, isn't it?
It's an incredible sight, yeah.
I'm with Lord Cavendish, who owns this estate. How long have your family been farming here?
400 years or something like that. The estate has never been bought or sold, so it's rather hard to know. Since the Reformation.
400 years to the very newest technology going out today.
Some of the plant is growing naturally just over there. Did you see that?
Yeah, that's because this is boggy. It would naturally grow here. Yeah.
And also I think we probably can control the water table up to a bit if there was a drought, because all this land is protected by sluices from the incoming tide.
Because we're practically on Morecambe Bay here.
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we I'm going to proceed with our operation.
There it goes. Up into the sky. David, really exciting morning for you. What are your hopes for this experimental crop here?
Yeah, well, we're hoping that it establishes really well, we get a really good crop growing, and then hopefully we can grow more of it.
Do you think other people might be tempted to give it a go round here on this sort of boggy ground near the estuary?
Absolutely, yeah. We ran a workshop, we invited some local farmers. There was a lot of interest, there was a lot of good discussion held, and a lot of people interested in potentially taking it forward. We're hoping people can learn from our mistakes with a trial crop, and we're hoping to show that it is a viable crop that can be grown.
And are you hoping you might get a free anorak out of it?
Very much so, yes.
David Harvey there with Kaz Graham. For the more mainstream crops, things like spring barley, it is a bit of a different picture, with the wet winter still affecting planting and, of course, the impact of higher fuel and fertiliser prices because of the conflict in the Middle East. So, overall, how's it looking? Anthony Spate is the Senior Cereals and Oilseed Analyst for the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board.
Despite the very wet winter that we've had, winter barley, winter oats, winter oilseed rape, the majority of that is well, it's all in the ground and it's all looking spectacular, dare I say. Obviously, farmers are ongoing now with spring drilling. And spring drilling is behind on heavier land, but it's progressing well on lighter soils. But if we just look on a regional level as well from this, in the Midlands and out east, Spring barley drilling is largely finished on lighter soils. This is reflecting the relatively good access and earlier drying. But as we head towards the north to heavier wetlands in Yorkshire and the northeast and even parts of the West Midlands, spring drilling remains relatively slow on these heavier, wetter soils, with access to these lands limited, and some fields still need more drying time to allow growers to get onto them.
Yeah, and presumably that delay is down in part to that extremely wet weather we had at the beginning of this year.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, we've had one of the wettest Januaries and Februaries on record. So yeah, it's been very, very, very challenging for the domestic grower. And we're finding that these extreme events are becoming more of a common theme for arable farmers.
And is that going to have an impact on when these crops, once they've grown, when they can be harvested? Will we be looking at a later harvest?
Not necessarily. I mean, we can't see any delays so far for harvest as such, and crops are faring relatively well despite that delay planting that was mentioned.
Now, the war in the Middle East means that fuel prices have just been soaring up, and there are concerns about fertiliser costs as well. Is that going to affect planting?
I mean, it's not really going to impact plantings as such. Obviously, what's going on at the moment, there's a large degree of volatility in fertiliser markets and energy markets. Although that's not going to affect plantings as such, it might actually impact the amount of fertiliser or late season nitrogen rates which are applied to these crops as fertiliser prices soar up. So you could definitely see some growers restricting the amount they are putting on these crops. We could see greater implications, especially on a domestic front, for 27 harvest if we get those fertiliser prices and they still remain high.
Farmers who were producing arable crops last year, some of them got some really low prices, and obviously with that bad weather as well. Do you think some people will have been, you know, weighing up whether to actually go ahead and plant again?
The UK is not a price maker. We're unfortunately a price taker to these global markets. And the global grain market, for the most part, is still very, very well supplied, with supply for this marketing year actually, for grains, actually outstripping demand.
So is it worth planting? I mean, have you seen farmers taking that into consideration and deciding not to plant cereals, maybe to do something else instead?
What we've seen actually in our early bird survey, which was published in November, we've actually seen a slight uptick in winter wheat, and we've seen a slight reduction actually in spring plantings.
Anthony Spate from the AHDB talking there with Kaz. Well, they mentioned the impact of conflict in the Middle East, and it's also led to government concerns about a shortage of CO2. It's an important ingredient in many food and drink production processes. It's used for a range of things, including stunning pigs in abattoirs, packaging salads, and making fizzy drinks. This week, the government awarded a £100 million grant to the Ensis factory at Redcar to restart production. As you may remember, the plant was mothballed last year after the trade deal with the USA removed tariffs on American bioethanol and so made domestic production uneconomic. The plant produces bioethanol, CO2 and animal feed. Well, its recommissioning could mean the return of a significant market for wheat that doesn't make the grade for human consumption. But the National Farmers Union are concerned that the £100 million investment from government is not conditional on Ensis using British wheat. Kaz Graham asked Grant Pearson, chairman of Ensis, where the grain for their plant comes from.
The plant uses feed grain, so this is not grain that can be used for making bread or cakes. It's grains that are grown for feeding to animals primarily. The vast majority of grain is UK wheat, and over the times the plant's been operating, most of it's come from about 50 miles around the plant.
And is it all UK crop that you use, or do you import some of it?
No, the majority is UK crops and UK wheat. We do bring in some maize, and when we first started the plant up, we actually we ran primarily on UK wheat, but we had some challenges in terms of running 100% on wheat. So we always put a little bit of maize into the plant. It gets the plant up and running at a much higher rate if we have a bit of maize in there. We have occasionally ran on larger maize volumes if there's been a particularly poor UK harvest. So if you remember a couple of years ago when we had that dreadful autumn of non-stop rain and the farmers were really struggling to get the wheat in the ground, and that had a very poor harvest the next year. The year after that, we tended to use a higher proportion of maize. And this is quite helpful because I think it takes pressure off the UK market when there has been a poor harvest. And on a normal harvest, it gives a big output and local consumption for grain in the northeast, which would otherwise be probably exported.
I know the NFU has been saying that the £100 million support from the government should be tied to you guaranteeing that, the wheat that you use, the grain you use, will be produced in the UK. I mean, what do you say to that?
I think you've got to understand the reason, the primary reason that the government has given the support to the plant is to make sure that we've got guaranteed CO2 supplies. The benefits for the fuel supply security, the farming benefits, both in terms of offtake for grain, but also, I think, as importantly and possibly even more importantly for security supply is the proteins that we produce. You know, the UK imports around about 2 million tonnes of proteins, and we're very, very susceptible to breakdown in global supply chains there. I think that's very much secondary from the government's perspective. Therefore, I don't see that they'd make that link. I do think from my side, however, we're very keen to support the local farmers, and we do our best to make sure we take a fair amount, if not a majority of our grains from local supplies.
The government statement announcing the support, it says in it, they're taking steps to diversify the UK's long-term CO2 supply and also to reduce future reliance on imports. I mean, reading between the lines, does that look like longer-term support for you? Are you and the farmers that supply you back in business, do you think?
From my side, I'm very keen to make sure this plant stays in production. I think it's important for the staff. We've had 10 months of uncertainty for the staff here. The vast majority have stayed with us. A lot of them have been with us since the plant was a start-up nearly 20 years ago. You know, this is really a welcome relief for them. Their jobs were very much in question for the last 10 months. And so we're very keen to make sure we try to keep it back online. And hopefully CO2 will play a part of that. But nothing's guaranteed at this stage. But we're going to work and prove that we add real value.
Grant Pearson, chairman of Ensis there. Spring is the start of the wildfire season in the UK, and this week has seen fires across the country, with two in West Yorkshire and a fire on Heathland in Dorset. Derbyshire Fire Service is urging people to take more care after they were also called to a wildfire across 18,000 square metres on Tuesday. Well, in a moment, we'll talk about the prospects for wildfires this year, but first let's hear from a farmer caught up in one last year. 2025 broke the records for the amount of land in the UK affected by wildfires. One on the North York Moors burned for more than 40 days, covering nearly 10 square miles of moorland. Farmer Phil Turford's flock of 600 Swaledale sheep had to be rescued from the moor as it burnt. Well, now, with the first lambs of the new season appearing, BBC Look North's Carla Fowler went to meet him to hear about the farm's recovery.
There's 400 yows to lambs, so we're hoping for a few more lambs than 400, but you never know. Yeah, as long as this weather holds up, we should be all right. Yeah.
The ones we're looking at, are these recent arrivals?
These are 2 or 3 days old. These are ones that just aren't quite right to put out yet. Would, if they're right, they go straight out and enjoy a bit more grass than usual. So, yeah.
Is it a relief? I know you were in the thick of it, fighting the fire last year.
It's new life, isn't it? It's renewing, so, yeah. Yeah, everything seems to be going pretty well. If this weather keeps up, it'll be very good.
And this is a real milestone for Leith Rigg Farm because this year's lambs were really not guaranteed after last year's wildfires on the moors destroyed basically all the common land. Now, you did lose many sheep in the fires, but thankfully managed to move most of them to safety and temporary grazing off the moor. What's that been like to manage?
We've got sheep in 3 different areas. We've lambed them slightly early because we didn't know whether we were going to get back onto the moor or whether we were going to have to sell them. So there's 400 sheep down here and there. We've put them to a cheviot tub. Usually they're all to a swale. Yeah, just a bit earlier, that's all, just because we didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah.
I mean, there are still challenges ahead, aren't there, for when you get the sheep back on the moor eventually?
Well, they'll have to get used to eating roughage again, yeah.
hopefully it'll come back. Some of it won't come back for like maybe 10, 15 years, but there will be quite a bit come back pretty soon. We did burn 300 acre roughly. Hopefully that'll come back this year.
Farmer Phil Turford in North Yorkshire there with a lamb. Dr. Matthew Jones from the University of East Anglia leads a group researching wildfires across the globe. He explained to me why the risk of them is so high in the spring.
April is traditionally the month with the most burned area in the UK. It comes as a surprise to many people. Many people think, oh, it must be in the summertime that we see more of these fires happening across our country. The reason for this is actually because over the previous summer, we get a lot of vegetation growing up. And then that actually dies off over the autumn and over the winter. And it's really in spring when that starts to dry out. We start getting these hotter, drier periods. And that can lead to the fuels that have accumulated the previous year kind of becoming ready to burn for the first time.
We have, though, had a very wet winter. Logically, shouldn't that slow the process?
I mean, yes, I think it's slightly taking us by surprise. You know, it has been incredibly wet. So, yeah, I mean, to see now things drying out so quickly is a little bit surprising. I think we've had some warm spells, but it's also been very windy, and that's something that also helps to dry out fuel and sort of wick away moisture from the surface and into the atmosphere. That's what's really driving some of the really rapid drying that we've been seeing this year.
It's not entirely clear how these latest ones started. What is the most common cause? What ignites wildfires?
It's a mixture of things, really. I mean, particularly nearer to urban centres, we tend to see people out in the landscape. That tends to be the most common cause of wildfires. We've, sort of course, get occasions where there's sort of lightning ignitions. That's the most common natural cause of wildfire. I don't think these sort of lightning events have been particularly common in the recent weeks. So, you know, it's most likely to be human-based ignitions.
Is there any agreement across the world on how best to manage land, moorland or heathland, to reduce the risks?
I'd say sort of a variety of approaches are implemented globally. So in terms of preemptive actions, there's various things we can do to try and control these events. So, you know, things like fuel management, so early season burning, using prescribed burns during times of year when it is safe to burn, has been very widely adopted globally, including in some of the most fire-prone places on earth, like in Australia and the US, for example. But other countries use different blends of policy and practice. So, for example, in Australia, we see essentially a total ban on the use of fire or machinery that creates sparks during periods when vegetation is extremely prone to burning. I think historically the UK, of course, hasn't been a particularly fire-prone place, so these issues are really coming to the fore here. We're starting to have these conversations now about, you know, what blend of approach is right for the UK and how we should be proceeding to manage our quite unique ecosystems.
And there are some very basic disagreements on how that should happen, aren't there? You know, whether you should burn, where you should burn, whether you should graze, how much you should graze.
Yeah, as with many things, the truth's often in the middle somewhere, and actually a blend of different approaches that is tailored to the landscape you're working on, really taking into account the type of vegetation, the type of fuels that you're dealing with. Also relying on the expertise and learned knowledge that landowners and land managers have built up over generations often. We have to work together as one to find the right solution where probably some mixture of approaches tailored to the environment really implemented in a sensible, structured way.
Dr. Matthew Jones. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Joe Pesey. And Farming Today This Week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Time for a look at the weather forecast. Now here's Simon King.
Charles, thanks so much indeed. We've got low pressure situated to the northwest of the UK through today and indeed into tomorrow as well, which means it's going to stay quite windy for many of us, particularly around Scotland and Northern Ireland and down the Irish Sea coasts. And this morning, it's quite wet out there. So this morning across southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, we've got this band of rain which is moving its way eastward fairly quickly. So in the next few hours, it should clear away to the east and there'll be some sunny spells developing for a time, because then the cloud does then increase again, and with that there'll be some showers coming in from the west, and as I said, a blustery wind, gusts up to 60 miles an hour around the Irish Sea coast and the Isle of Man through today. And some of the showers could be quite heavy, maybe some hail, some thunderstorms mixed in, particularly for Wales, the Midlands and northwest England. Temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. Now, for South East England, Eastern and North East England, quite cloudy this morning. Rain not quite with you yet, but it will do so in the next hour or so. Moving in from the west, it'll be quite light and quite patchy towards Eastern and South Eastern areas of England. The rain will take a little time to clear away, so by lunchtime, really, that will clear to the east. There'll be quite a bit of cloud, but then that cloud breaks up this afternoon to bring some sunshine. But then again, there will be a bit more cloud later on this afternoon, some showers coming into North East England in particular. And temperatures 11 to 14 Celsius. Now for Northern Ireland, the rain has actually already cleared here, so some clear skies this morning, quite chilly. Cloud increasing quite quickly without some passing showers through the day. Blustery conditions, temperatures of 9 or 10 degrees. And across Scotland, pretty wet this morning, some mountain snow, some gales around the northern and western isles. Rain clearing eventually to the east, there'll be some sunny spells, but then more showers coming into the southwest, pushing northeastward into the afternoon. And we'll see maximum temperatures today of about 7 to 10 degrees Celsius.
Simon King. Today is coming up in just a moment. First, though, as James Herriot used to say at times like this, hot water, soap and a towel.
That's Betty. Leading a charge.
Come with us on a guided tour through the digestive system of a cow.
A handful of soil has more living organisms in it than there are people on the planet.
From the ground all the way through.
They have a forestomach, and this forestomach is huge.
And back out again.
A dung pap from a cow is a really, really important habitat.
Join a cheesemaker, a philosopher, a scientist, and a farmer. Journey through a cow on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tomorrow night at 7:15.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and smart speakers, this is Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 11th of April. This is Today with Justin Webb and Sean Farrington.
The headlines this morning.
Splashdown confirmed.
Copy splashdown, waiting on VLDR.
From the pages of Jules Verne to a modern-day mission to the moon, a new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete. Integrity's astronauts, back on Earth.
The crew of NASA's Artemis lunar mission have returned safely to Earth, ending their historic voyage into space. And one other headline, peace talks between Iran and the United States are due to get underway in Pakistan, but there is still mistrust and confusion.
And after 8 o'clock, we will hear from the first British astronaut who undertook the 24,000 miles an hour plunge back to planet Earth.
The re-entry is the biggest ride of the whole mission. It's the most physically demanding. All that energy that was put in with that enormous rocket at the beginning during the launch has to come out in order for us to slow down sufficiently.
Also in the next hour.
Over the hills and far away. Teletubbies come to play.
As CITV comes off UK televisions and onto streaming, we will ask the creator of Teletubbies why she's so concerned about the future of children's TV.
I'm Natalie Perks with your Saturday Sport, and Rory McIlroy is flying in his quest to become only the fourth man in history to retain the Masters. He has a record 6-shot lead at the halfway stage. Later, we'll be looking at the build-up to the Grand National at Aintree and the start of the Women's Six Nations.
The BBC News this morning is read by Charles Carroll.
The four astronauts of the Artemis lunar mission have returned to Earth after completing the first crewed voyage to the moon in more than half a century. Their Orion capsule splashed down safely in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California after nearly 10 days in space. NASA described it as a textbook touchdown and said the crew were all in excellent shape. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, sent this report from Mission Control in Houston.
Multiple airborne assets as part of the recovery team all have visuals on Integrity. Still do not have communications from the crew.
A first glimpse of the Integrity spacecraft appearing as a fast-moving speck of light high above the ocean. Then confirmation the crew was safe.
Integrity, Houston, comm check post-blackout.
Houston, Integrity, we have you loud and clear.
They're just hurtled through the atmosphere at 24,000 miles an hour. Their spacecraft enduring temperatures as hot as the surface of the sun.
Splashdown confirmed at 7.07 p.m. Central Time. A modern-day mission to the moon. A new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete.
The Artemis astronauts were back on Earth. The cramped capsule that had been their home for the last 10 days bobbing on the waves. The door was opened, for that first breath of fresh Earth air, and the astronauts were airlifted one by one by helicopter to the recovery ship nearby. Jared Isaacman, NASA's head, was waiting on board.
I'm still at a loss for words. I mean, you know, like the childhood Jared right now can't believe what I just saw. I mean, almost been waiting my whole lifetime to see this.
The US Space Agency says this is just the start. It's planning a lunar landing for 2028 and a moon base. This mission has exceeded expectations for NASA, the millions of people who followed every step of this epic journey, and, not least of all, the astronauts themselves.
Peace talks between Iran and the United States aimed at ending their six-week conflict are due to get started shortly in Pakistan. The Iranian delegation arrived overnight, while the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, has landed in the last few minutes. Progress towards peace has been threatened by continued Israeli strikes on the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon. From Islamabad, our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis reports.
After weeks of speculation, talks in Islamabad seem about to commence. The sound of Pakistani jets echoed through the city skies just after midnight as they accompanied in the Iranian arrivals. Leading their delegation is the parliamentary speaker, Mohammed Bagheer Ghalibaf, along with the foreign minister Abbas Araghchi. They were met at the airport with a red carpet and flowers. Mr. Ghalibaf shared images of seats on their plane filled with the burnt school bags and pictures of the schoolgirls killed in an airstrike on the first day of the war. The stakes are high, the gap between the two countries' positions wide. Getting both sides to Islamabad was the first hurdle. It will not be the last.
Lebanon's president has confirmed that representatives of his country and Israel will meet in Washington next week to discuss an end to Israel's conflict with Hezbollah. From Jerusalem, Jill Gunter reports.
The war between Israel and Hezbollah has been a major sticking point in the US-Iran ceasefire process because Israel has continued to bombard Hezbollah in Lebanon since that deal was announced. Israel and the Lebanese government have now agreed to begin talks next week in Washington, but the two sides have issued very different messages about what those talks will cover. A statement from the Lebanese president's office said they would discuss announcing a ceasefire and setting a date for the start of negotiations. Israel's ambassador said his country had agreed to begin peace negotiations, but refused to discuss a ceasefire with Hezbollah. Lebanese authorities say nearly 2,000 people have been killed in Israeli strikes since the recent conflict began.
Sir Keir Starmer has shelved plans for the UK to transfer sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the United States failed to give formal approval to the deal. Government officials have insisted they're not entirely abandoning the agreement. Our political correspondent Joe Pike has more details.
In January, President Trump called the plan an act of total weakness. He has urged Sir Keir to scrap the deal, despite previously expressing support for the treaty. The deal would see the UK cede sovereignty of the territory to Mauritius and pay an average cost of £101 million a year to lease back a joint UK-US military base on the largest island. The government has said it still believes the agreement is the best way to protect the long-term future of the base, but has conceded it can only go ahead with US support. Ministers have run out of time to pass legislation before Parliament is dissolved in the coming weeks. A fresh Chagos bill is not expected to feature in the King's speech next month. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has said the fact it took so long to shelve this deal is another damning indictment of the Prime Minister.
A 77-year-old British man has died after a bus carrying more than two dozen tourists crashed into a ravine in La Gomera in the Canary Islands. Six other people are in hospital. They had all been travelling to catch a ferry to Tenerife. The National Association of Head Teachers is demanding that the government steps in to help retired teachers who've been left waiting for thousands of pounds of delayed pension payments. The teachers' pension scheme is one of the biggest in the country, with 2 million members. It's administered by Capita, but the Department for Education has overall responsibility. Here's Hannah Mullane from Radio 4's Moneybox.
Teachers say they are notifying the pension scheme that they want to retire, filling out the relevant paperwork, and then when their retirement date comes, the money they were expecting, sometimes thousands of pounds in lump sums, doesn't arrive. Many complain that when they contact the teachers' pension scheme, they get no clarity on why there is a delay or when they will receive their money. Capita has apologised and said it was working closely with the government to ensure cases were progressed correctly and in line with the scheme rules. The National Association of Head Teachers is urging the government to step in and provide more resources to deal with late payments. The Department for Education says it's working closely with CAPITA to monitor performance and address any emerging issues.
And you can hear more on that story on Moneybox at midday on Radio 4 or on BBC Sounds. A spokesman for Prince Harry has rejected what he called offensive legal action against him by a charity which he helped to found. Centre Male, which supports young people in southern Africa, says it's suing for defamation because of what it calls an adverse media campaign. A spokesman for the Duke of Sussex and another former trustee who's being sued said that they categorically rejected the offensive and damaging claims against them. Almost 12,000 people who were given meningitis B vaccinations during a deadly outbreak in Kent are to be offered second doses from next week. 21 cases were linked to the outbreak last month. Two people died. Those eligible will be able to book in for a second dose online. And the Grand National takes place at Aintree this afternoon, where the Irish trainer Willie Mullins is looking to make history. It's the biggest race in the British calendar, with millions of pounds bet on the outcome. Our sports news correspondent Andy Swiss has the details.
Aintree's showpiece event offers an array of potentially historic storylines. Willie Mullins will be hoping to become the first trainer to win the Grand National 3 years in a row since Vincent O'Brien more than 70 years ago. While his winning horse last year, Nick Rocket, has been withdrawn from the race, Mullins still has a number of strong contenders, including the 2024 champion I Am Maximus. Irish trainers have dominated in recent years, but prospects of a British winner include Panic Attack, which could become the first mare to win the National since Nicol Coyne in 1951. The horse is trained by Dan Skelton and ridden by his brother Harry. After last year's triumph for Willie Mullins with his son Patrick in the saddle, Aintree could produce another family success story.
That was Andy Swiss.
Thank you, Charles. It is just coming up to 7:10 and we can say welcome home to Reed, to Victor, to Christina and to Jeremy. Overnight, the Artemis II crew splashed down in the Pacific Ocean after an 11-day mission that has changed the face of space travel. Their return to planet Earth began just after midnight last night after their capsule, named Integrity, was given approval for re-entry by NASA. The voice you'll hear first here is Rob Navias from Mission Control.
Our trajectory is right on according to flight dynamics. Integrity is on a trajectory from southwest and northeast across the Pacific Ocean, descending at a rate of 15,000 feet per second. Range to touchdown, 4,300 nautical miles. All the systems in excellent shape.
Integrity, Orion in the EI roll 180 attitude.
Looks good on board, Jackie. Houston, purge is complete. Crew and vehicle are configured for entry.
And that was the mission commander on board, Reid Wiseman, at the end there. About 10 to 1 this morning, Artemis hit entry interface. So this is the moment that capsule meets the top of Earth's atmosphere, around 400,000 feet up, hurtling in at more than 24,000 miles an hour. It came within a whisker of the record set by Apollo 10 back in 1969.
10 seconds till entry interface. And we have crossed the threshold, now entering the Earth's atmosphere. We're at 400,000 feet, traveling 34,800 feet per second. Time to splash down, 13 minutes, 10 seconds.
Then, for the next 6 minutes, the blackout began. Not a single word came from the astronauts, total radio silence, and then a signal from the capsule.
Integrity, Houston, comm check, post-blackout.
Houston, Integrity, we have you loud and clear.
Your trajectory is nominal, and your recovery teams have visual.
Guidance looks good.
Now, by now, they'd dropped to about 100,000 feet, the crew having already ridden through peak heating, so close to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Next up came the moment everyone was waiting for, parachute deployment.
And there go the first series of parachutes. And we're on drogues.
And Houston, we're visual. Two drogues out the window.
Two good drogue chutes. Next up.
We copy. We see them.
Next up, the deployment of pilot parachutes that will pull the main chutes out. Time to splash down, 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
So unsurprisingly, then, the Pacific Ocean did come into view. Splash down just moments away.
Houston, Integrity, splash down, sending post landing command now.
Splashdown confirmed.
Copy splashdown. Waiting on VLDR.
Splashdown confirmed at 7:07 p.m. Central Time, 5:07 p.m. Pacific Time. From the pages of Jules Verne to a modern-day mission to the moon, a new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete. Integrity's astronauts, back on Earth.
So the U.S. Navy then helped them exit the Orion spacecraft and that the Pacific Ocean by 3 a.m. All four astronauts have been lifted by helicopters. We had a news conference in Houston where the flight director said the astronauts are happy and healthy, ready to come home to Houston. Laurie Glaze, who's the head of the program, the Artemis program, said they'd return to Houston on Saturday, where they'll expect to hear from them here on planet Earth for the first time. So over the next couple of hours, we'll unpack what these last 11 extraordinary days have taught us, what Artemis might mean for the future of space travel, and hear from those who've actually made that plunge back through Earth's atmosphere to tell us what re-entry really feels like.
It is 13 minutes past seven. Let us turn back to earthly affairs. Iran, the United States meeting today in Pakistan. As we were hearing in the news, the Vice President, J.D. Vance, just arrived there. The two sides, though, still very far apart, including on the basic question of whether Israel needs to stop its military action in southern Lebanon in order for the talks to progress, which is something the Iranians say is essential. Let us talk then to Hugo Bashega, who is the BBC's Middle East correspondent and joins us now from Beirut. Is there any sign, Hugo, of Israel's military action stopping?
Well, it was a very busy day yesterday, Justin, in terms of Israeli airstrikes and also in terms of Hezbollah attacks against Israel. But Beirut wasn't hit yesterday, which could be an indication that Israel is de-escalating its conflict against Lebanon. But we'll see. I think, you know, for President Trump, it is essential for the ceasefire in Iran to hold. So I think if he sees that the situation here in Lebanon risking, you know, derailing the deal, he will simply demand a ceasefire here. He will put pressure on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, as he has, to stop the war. There's been international condemnation already, international pressure on Israel to stop, because again, you know, just days ago we had the deadliest day in Lebanon in its history, in its recent history. 300 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes. The Lebanese say at least a third of them were civilians, women, children, elderly people. So Israel is already under international pressure, a lot of pressure to de-escalate, if not to stop the war here.
What is their aim?
So they say that they want to push Hezbollah away from the border. So there is not only, you know, we've seen not only these massive airstrikes, but there's also an invasion of the country. Israeli troops are occupying parts of the south where they say they want to create a so-called security buffer zone along the border. So they have already succeeded in weakening Hezbollah and isolating Hezbollah domestically. So some of its, you know, goals in the war have already been achieved. They will never be able to disarm Hezbollah by force. So, you know, we're talking about the possibility of direct talks between the Israelis and the Lebanese to try to come up with a deal, to try to reach lasting peace. But, you know, Hezbollah's disarmament will never happen by force. There needs to be a deal. And Hezbollah so far has refused to engage in any kind of negotiations to disarm. So this is a very complicated situation. And stuck in the middle is this country, Lebanon. So if there is no deal to disarm Hezbollah, this state of permanent war here in Lebanon is unlikely to come to an end.
Okay, Hugo Bashega, thank you very much. Let us turn to Caroline Davis, who's a Pakistan correspondent, who's in Islamabad, where these talks are meant to be taking place today. A lot of things, Caroline, up in the air.
Yes, although not currently the Vice President, J.D. Vance, who has now touched down in Islamabad. We started to get an indication that he might be coming in because we heard Pakistani fighter jets coming in overhead across Islamabad. We heard the same sort of thing just after midnight last night when the Iranian delegation arrived. So both sides now here in the Pakistan capital. The big question is, of course, how do these talks take shape? We still haven't been given clarity about whether they will be in the same room or whether there will be messages being passed back and forth between them. And of course, we still have some questions about the fact that the Iranian parliamentary speaker, of course, yesterday said that there would not be negotiations unless there was a ceasefire in Lebanon, as well as the unfreezing of certain assets. So will that throw a further spanner in the works? Pakistan, I think, will be relieved that at least at this stage, after many weeks of speculation, even this week when both sides had said that they were attending, speculation about whether they would actually both land in Islamabad, first hurdle cleared maybe, but several more up ahead.
Yeah, and among them, a practical one, it would seem, at least according to the reporting of the New York Times overnight, that when America demands that the Strait of Hormuz is reopened, that actually that might not be possible because the Iranians have put mines in it and now can't find them.
Well, I mean, I think there'll be plenty of many logistical challenges of how this, you know, there might be demands on one side, whether they're practically possible to achieve on the other is going to be a big question. But I also think that there are so many hurdles that both sides have to try to overcome. Lots of the Iranian demands that have been put out through the Iranian state media just seem to be completely unacceptable to the United States. There doesn't really seem to be an enormous amount of common ground between the two sides. And yet the fact that they are both here in the country, many are seeing as a sign that there is some desire to do something, to find some form of resolution. But there seems to be absolutely zero trust between both sides. And what they could practically actually manage to hammer out is really unclear.
Caroline Davis in Islamabad. Thank you very much.
19 minutes past seven. Those logistical issues of opening up the Strait of Hormuz, never mind the political issues around it, are causing increasing problems for the aviation industry. European airports warning that a jet fuel shortage is imminent if that strait isn't opened up within 3 weeks. About half of jet fuel for European airports is from the Gulf region, and most of it needs to travel through that crucial passage to be delivered. John Strickland is an airline analyst. John, morning. It might have felt like European flights and airports have been a bit shielded in recent weeks compared to other airlines and airports around the world. Is it getting a bit closer to a pinch point here?
I think there is a pinch point coming. I've been sounding out a number of airlines and trade bodies, and certainly there's a sense of calm, but that doesn't mean complacency. As you said, a substantial share of jet fuel in Europe does come from the Gulf, and while there are other sources, there are many challenges of obtaining other fuel supplies, especially at short notice, and it's not something you can suddenly turn on and off. So what I'm hearing from most players in the industry is that certainly the remainder of this month, running into part of May, looks okay. After that, it's a bit more unclear. And perhaps if you want to put it in a particular way, the canary in the coal mine is Michael O'Leary, who has publicly spoken of the fact that potentially Ryanair might have to cancel in the region of 5 to 10% of its flights beyond the later May period if this shortage does actually transpire.
Well, quite. And if you're saying, you know, up till maybe the beginning of May, things are looking all right, but then there are the big questions in front of the Telegraph, as other places do this morning, reflect on half-term holiday bookings, maybe the start of the summer holidays as well. Would you expect there to be a sort of change in habits of people booking flights, even if the flights aren't cancelled just yet?
I wouldn't think so at the moment, and airlines, of course, are keen to reassure customers, both those who've already got bookings and those making them. We are, of course, in a time of year when we're progressively building up to the summer peak now. From the point of view of airlines, it would, if they had to face this challenge, it would be far more preferable if it was in the winter months like November and January when travel is light. But as you said, we have a number of holidays in May and we move up towards that summer peak of June, July. But airlines will look to do their absolute utmost to make sure they protect the flying they plan to operate and protect customers who are booked, and indeed be able to take additional bookings. So they have various techniques they can employ, for example something called tankering, where if fuel is not available in one place, it's a bit like going to a petrol forecourt with your car and the price is better than elsewhere, so you fill it up to the maximum. Planes can do that in one airport, right? If it's not available in a normal supply point.
Does that make some airports more vulnerable than others though, John, if there is this sort of changing demand at various airports around the continent?
That's certainly the case, and the point that the airport trade body, ACI, made in their letter to the European Commission was that you have small airports, again, a bit like small petrol forecourts, that are not a big part of dealer distribution networks. They're last on the list to get fuel. They don't have maybe direct pipes in from refineries, as some large airports do. They don't have large reserves in the way that some major airports do. So certainly the small ones, perhaps dotted around regional points in Europe, are at risk. And that, in turn, brings the question of government involvement, which is what ACI is saying. They need to see the EU states getting together to look at what reserves are available and how supply can be assured. Airlines, again, would be concerned about flying, for example, in regional parts of Europe, more remote, where aviation is absolutely the only means to get people around. It can't be just left to chance as to what would happen there in the event of a shortage.
John, thank you for your time. John Strickland there, airline analyst.
The time, 23 minutes past seven.
Now, if you are a child of the 90s or you had kids then, if you didn't have the Today programme on a Saturday morning, these sounds from ITV might have been a little more familiar.
This is an art attack? This is an art attack? This is Art Attack!
Two,
trois, three.
That's TV.
An eclectic selection for you there. What do we have? Art Attack, Nightmare, Rainbow and TOTS TV at the end. After 40 years now, though, of dedicated airtime for kids' TV on ITV's linear channels, most recently at breakfast time on ITV2, there will now be none of that. It's all going to shift to the ITVX kids streaming platform. I've got TOTS TV creator Anne Wood with us now. Anne, good morning to you. Anne founded Ragdoll Productions, specialising in programmes for young children as well. So you've got Teletubbies and Rosie and Jim under your watch previously as well. And so how does it feel to you to think ITV, those linear channels, aren't going to be focusing on this so much?
Well, no, I mean, they haven't been for ages. I mean, this has been going on, this process of dismantling the infrastructure, if you like, that made some of these programs possible, that parents really do, young parents now, is very interesting. We aren't a broadcaster, we're an independent production company. But because Ragdoll has done a lot of programs for young children, parents of young children are now emailing us saying, can't you do something about it? Because they're searching for programs like TOTS TV, funnily enough, that they remember for being more calm or more meaningful or funnier. Because, you know, making children laugh is a really important thing. And they want that kind of viewing experience, which is a little bit more meaningful. What they say to us are things like, we're looking for things that are more emotionally grounded. So we've lost it already, if you see what I mean, because there's absolutely no money going to go into this.
Well, if there's a demand there, Anne, you know, you're getting those emails coming in. When you speak to, whether it's the streaming networks or those in charge of those linear TV channels, why are they not so keen for that content?
Because they haven't any money. The money for children's television has been completely withdrawn and the market has disappeared. All nations appear to be doing this, thinking that the technology is more important than the content. Therefore, they will just put everything away. And there is no money in streaming for making these programmes. I mean, they cost a lot of money. Just as any drama for adults will cost. You know, you need the same stuff. You need the same cameras. You need the same technology to make children's programmes as you do any others. So it's terribly sad for me anyway. I mean, I had a lovely time. I mean, I made these programs. I loved them. We had children who were fans and still do have. I mean, there's a teacher recently took up TOTS TV and made a whole school project out of it. We loved it. We engaged. I shouldn't say this on air because we might get other schools writing it. But, you know, it still resonates with people. But the people who watched are now parents themselves. And I just hope that they will rise up and get in touch with the select committee or whatever it is that's looking into children's programmes yet again and do something.
Because what is it, Anne, that's the difference in the rewards for those the platforms, that they are happy putting the money into adult drama but not happy putting it into kids' programmes so much? Because surely if you get it right, you look at the Bluey explosion in recent years. You know, everywhere you look now, every shop you go into, there's something affiliated to what is one of the most popular kids' TV programmes on TV at the moment. Aren't the rewards there?
No, not in the same way. There is a creative risk. I mean, you have to invest in anything for children, you know, whether it's nursery education, which is also underfunded, you know, or television for children, requires an investment. And also, of course, we've now got YouTube, you know, and we've got technology that allows a young child, even a young baby, to have a mobile, you know, as a distraction. The climate, the landscape has completely changed that we're in. And this is happening all over the world. So your chances of international, cooperation and sales are much, much less. Mm. And so all of the departments, I mean, the sad thing is there used to be people who understood the development of children, who were trained, who knew how to entertain children. And now this is not valued. There are no departments anywhere any longer for this work to be learned, for the infrastructure to survive by the skills being passed on. It started in the 80s with the Communications Act and the unforeseen consequence of allowing ITV not to meet their statutory obligation to make children's programmes.
Well,
that was diluted.
And maybe that was one of the steps that got us to where we are today. Anne Wood there, thank you for your time, Anne, founder of Ragdoll Productions.
29 minutes past seven to the sport. Here's Natalie.
Good morning. A big story overnight is Rory McIlroy. Before last year, Augusta had never really been his friend. But after winning the green jacket for the first time, something seems to have shifted at the Masters. He is sailing serenely into the last 2 days on 12 under with a huge 6-point lead over the chasing pack. Now, the women's Six Nations gets underway today with world champions England bidding for an 8th successive title and a 5th consecutive Grand Slam. The Red Roses start their defence against Ireland at Allianz Stadium. It's their first time back there since beating Canada in September's World Cup final.
Canada turn it over at the mall, but it matters not because England are World Cup champions. Red Roses on home soil and before 80,000.
Well, I'm delighted to say the Chief Executive of the RFU, Bill Sweeney, joins us now. Bill, good morning. It's great to have you with us.
Morning, Natalie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. According to research commissioned by BBC Sports, we've seen supporter numbers in the UK climb from around 8 million to over 13 million after the World Cup. And I know we often talk about legacy in sport, but is this the first real sign of the legacy, I guess, from having the Women's World Cup here?
Yeah, definitely. That rise in following from 8 million to 30 million is terrific. But all of the stats that you look at the moment, whether it's women's and girls' registrations in the game, which is up by 14%, whether you talk to PWR and you look at their audience figures and their attendances, both up by over 80%, all the stats are showing that there's a real explosion in popularity and following behind the women's game at the moment.
So you've been Chief Executive, 7 years? What differences have you particularly seen in the women's game and what changes are happening at grassroots?
We were the first to award full professional contracts back in 2019. We've really invested very heavily into women's sport. We've lost money on it over the last 4 years, but we don't see that as a loss. We see that as an investment. So we've lost 18 million over 4 years, but that's really us saying that it's actually critical for the growth of the game, not just the women's game, but the game overall, to have a really strong, thriving women's and girls game. And we're seeing improvements in the professional standards at PWR. You're seeing the Red Roses really laying out the standard and setting a very high bar in terms of performance and aspiration. And they've really connected with the young fans and given them entertainment and experiences that they're coming back for. And that'll be shown today when we've got over 76,000 people coming for the first match of the Women's Six Nations.
I mean, it helps that England have won a record 33 matches in a row, I guess, to get bums on seats. But I suppose one of the criticisms of the Six Nations is it can be a bit one-sided. Are the other home nations getting more competitive, would you say?
Yeah, they are. They're definitely closing the gap. And the other unions are starting to invest now in a similar sort of fashion. And that's great to see. I hear this about the fact that maybe it's too much of a one-horse race at the moment. But we don't hear that from the fans. I mean, the fact that you've got 76,000 turning up today, I think, is testament to that. They're coming for the experience. They're coming to follow their heroes. They're coming for the entertainment. And it's nice to win consistently like that. So we're not going to take our foot off the gas, and John Mitchell and ourselves aren't going to scale back in terms of what we're doing with the Red Roses. We'll continue to invest, we'll continue to raise the bar, and it's up to the other nations to catch up.
Of course, England's men went into their Six Nations campaign as one of the favourites too, emerged with 4 defeats from 5. There were Six Nations in history. I know you've got a deep dive review ongoing. What do you see are the clear issues? What needs to happen?
Yeah, it was hugely disappointing. I mean, we went in with there were high expectations that were well written up at the time. We were coming in off a 11-match unbeaten run. We won the first match against Wales, and then we just didn't deliver to the standard we'd expected to deliver. It'd be wrong to talk in too much detail now about the things that we're finding out and the things that we felt were not quite right at the time. But it's good that it's happened now with 18 months to go before a World Cup, and we'll sort them out and we'll come back stronger.
And will Steve Borthwick still be in the job for that World Cup?
Yeah, we're working with him at the moment in terms of what the issues were, and our intention is to make sure he's got the right support behind him, he's got the right mechanisms and processes around him to enable this great squad of players to deliver what they can deliver and go and do really well in Australia in 27.
And finally, very briefly, what are you most looking forward to with this Six Nations?
Just a continuing level of play from the team. We've got a lot of changes, 8 changes today through pregnancies and injury. It's a chance for John to really deepen and broaden the squad. I'm looking forward to getting there into the stadium today and just looking at that connection again between the players and the fans. I mean, they love each other, and it's really refreshing to see.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us today. Enjoy the Six Nations. And after England face Ireland, Wales take on Scotland at the Principality Stadium in Cardiff. And of course, it's the biggest day in the jump racing calendar today, the Grand National at Aintree at 4 p.m. That means we've got racing tips for you. In the 3:05, we're going for number 5, Home by the Lee. And at 4 o'clock for the National, number 22, Jaguar. And please don't blame me if they're wrong.
Natalie, thank you for that. Broadcasting House returns tomorrow. Jane Hill has the details.
With talks scheduled in Pakistan about ending the Iran war, we'll have a full briefing. After this week's horrifying images of 250 dogs rescued from one home, the new owners of two of them tell me how they're settling in. We hear about the benefits of exercise for people living with Parkinson's from a gold medal winner at the Ping Pong Parkinson World Championships. And reviewing the Sunday papers, commentator Peter Hitchens, comedian Alexi Sale, and the QI queen Anna Tuchinsky. Do join us 9 a.m. on Sunday.
Let's have a look at the weather now. Today will start cloudy with rain reaching the southeast, showers in the west. In the afternoon, some sunny spells will develop. Windy in the west.
The time is 8:25. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Sean Farrington, Justin Webb and Charles Carroll with the news.
NASA says the crew of the Artemis 2 mission are in excellent shape after returning safely to Earth, having travelled beyond the far side of the moon. Their Orion spacecraft splashed down in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California after 9 days in space, in what the space agency described as a textbook touchdown. The US Vice President, J.D. Vance, has arrived in Islamabad for talks with Iran aimed at ending their 6-week conflict. Tehran says that it's ready for a deal with the United States, but that any agreement will depend on Washington recognizing Iran's rights. President Trump has said that the Strait of Hormuz will be opened with or without the Iranians. Lebanese officials say that their country's representatives will meet their Israeli counterparts at the US State Department on Tuesday. Israel's ambassador in Washington has confirmed that formal peace talks will begin. Israel's continued attacks on Hezbollah in Iran have threatened to undermine peace talks. Sir Keir Starmer has put on hold plans to transfer the sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the United States withheld formal approval. The government insists the agreement has not been abandoned. Reform UK said shelving the deal was long overdue. The Lib Dems said that the handling of the Chagos deal had been shambolic. A 77-year-old British man has died after a coach carrying more than 24 tourists crashed into a ravine in La Gomera in the Canary Islands. 4 people were seriously injured, 2 of them were airlifted to hospital. The group had been travelling to catch a ferry to Tenerife. And almost 12,000 people who were given meningitis B vaccinations during a deadly outbreak in Kent are to be offered second doses from next week. 21 cases were linked to the outbreak last month, in which 2 people died. Those eligible will be able to book in for a second dose online.
Thank you for that. 23 minutes to 8 is the time. On the 13th of June 2023 in the city of Nottingham, Valdo Calacane stabbed to death 19-year-old students Barnaby Webber and Grace O'Malley Kumar and a grandfather, Ian Coates. The killer, who had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia 3 years earlier, then drove into the city centre where he struck three pedestrians with a van, again leaving them with life-changing injuries. The authorities failed again and again to keep a very obviously dangerous man, a man they viewed as dangerous, off the streets. They then failed to offer proper support to the victims. It led to the setting up of a public inquiry that's been taking evidence and will eventually issue recommendations. But with what impact? The former senior Home Office official Ian Aitchison, writing in The Telegraph last week, referred to a system that instinctively circles the wagons, centres perpetrators and processes, puts reputation management before ethics, and quietly edges victims, harm and accountability off the stage. I've been talking to James Coates, Ian Coates' son, who began by telling me about his father.
Happy-go-lucky sort of guy. You know, he'd worked hard all his life to provide for his family and help his friends, and was obviously getting really close to his retirement and looking forward to that, to get some rest. And such a nice guy, a big, like, friendly character.
How did you find out that he'd been killed?
I'd got a message on social media at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 13th of June from a friend of the family, like she had heard. We didn't get assigned a family liaison officer for 6 days after. So it was really hard those 6 days without any support. Obviously, none of us had been in a situation like this before. So we didn't know who to turn to, who we can talk to. Like, it was, we were just like left to our own devices to like just cope on our own and for the first week, more or less.
And that was only the beginning of police failings, wasn't it? Their failure to get in touch with you, but it didn't stop there.
No, it's just got gradually worse as time has gone on. And now we're like almost 3 years on from the day, and it's, yeah, there's still more information coming out at the minute.
Is it true that you were told you should get a dog?
That was my dad's partner, Elaine, was told that when she was spoke to victim support and obviously was sharing the issues that she was lonely and that she didn't like being in the house on her own because my dad wasn't there. And she was basically told to get a dog to cheer her up or to go move, sell the house and go and live by the seaside.
Well, when it came to the various inquiries that there have been, because there have been inquiries, haven't there, within various official bodies, what more have you learned?
Since this inquiry started, I've learned a whole lot more than what I did know previously. I think over the last 2.5 years, we'd found out a lot about missed opportunities, laziness, like failure to act, really. But now in the inquiry, we're just finding out so much more information. It's just, yeah, it's a lot to take on.
Give us an example of the kind of missed opportunities that you're talking about.
The repeat number of times that he was violent and should have been arrested. The times that he'd been sectioned and kept being released back into the public. They knew that he shouldn't be around students and in isolation, but they kept sending him back to student accommodation where he was just continuing to attack fellow students and break into students' apartments. And they just thought the best idea was to just keep sending him back there. And things like that, just little tiny things. If you'd done the job properly, it could have turned, this whole situation could have been completely different.
Is it clearer to you now why they didn't do the job properly?
I wouldn't say clearer. I'd say that I understand now the actions they've took and or didn't take, more or less. It's just, like I say, like the what's come out of the inquiry with just like the lack of leadership, the lack of experience, the lack of everything, really. I think it's got to a point where the culture has been so toxic and like corner cutting and taking shortcuts and things like that have become such the norm that it happens so often that there is no repercussions. But with something like this, everything is being brought out into the public, and it's now it's time for changes now. So,
one of the psychiatrists who has addressed the inquiry said the team of professionals
considered the research evidence that shows overrepresentation of young black males in detention. And he seemed to suggest that that was one of the reasons why Kalakane was not detained at the various stages that he could have been.
It shouldn't have even been a discussion. It doesn't matter what colour you are, what race, what religion. It's if you're committing a crime or you need to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act, then it should just happen. It shouldn't matter who you are or why or what. It has to happen. And because of stupid things like this, it didn't happen. And he was allowed to roam the streets and attack people.
Do you feel, and you've been watching, haven't you, the various professional bodies, representatives at the inquiry, do you feel that they understand the gravity of this and what needs to change?
Some of them do. I think a few individuals have realised the mistakes that were made and have held their hands up to it and apologised. But I think the main problem is there's a lot of them, and a lot of the senior people are the ones that feel that they've done the job properly and that there was nothing more they could have done. And that's basically just feels like a kick in the teeth, really. The emphasis from the police is that it was all down to there wasn't enough money, there's no budget, there's no staff, there's like lack of police officers, lack of experience, too much workload. That's what a lot of the blame is being put on, that the cops in Nottinghamshire have got too much to do, so they can't be everywhere at once, and that's why things like this happen, which to me is just not good enough.
Do you think anything is going to change as a result of this inquiry? Because there have been plenty of inquiries before, haven't there, along similar lines and promises that things would change. Will it now, do you think?
I have a tiny little sliver of hope that there could be some changes made. I'm hoping the chair, obviously, when she's seen everything laid out in front of her, she can make recommendations that can be put into practice. Because we've heard it for decades now. It's a blanket apology. One person might resign and then it just falls back into the same bad habits again.
James Coates, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And I should say Nottingham Police told us they wouldn't be commenting while the inquiry is ongoing, but they have in the past apologised to the families, to all the families, for failings. And NHS England has also apologised unreservedly to the families of the victims, says what happened was not acceptable.
It's 7:45.
Now, they made it back, and by all accounts, it was a perfect landing. Those four astronauts on Artemis having to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at the right angle, at the right speed, the right time, and they managed it all.
Integrity and her crew, four astronauts, flew 700,237 miles. We reached a peak velocity of 24,664 miles per hour. We hit our flight path angle target within 0.4%. We flew an entry range of 1,957 miles, and we landed within less than a mile of our target. What a tremendous day.
That was Rob Henfling, who was the Artemis flight director, speaking at a press conference just a few hours ago. Let's talk to Kevin Fong, doctor and broadcaster, who used to work with NASA's Human Spaceflight Program in Houston and is host of the 16 Sunsets podcast about the history of NASA's spaceflight shuttle program. Kevin, good morning to you.
Morning.
I mean, I suppose relief is one of the emotions, isn't it?
Massive relief. And, you know, I held my breath for the launch, but as my colleagues in Houston always said, the two hardest things in all of human space exploration are starting and stopping, and this is the mother of all stops, and you heard it there. So, yes, huge, huge relief.
And also some question about the heat shield that protected them during the re-entry, because previously, a previous heat shield, it wasn't that it failed, was it? But it showed signs of wear that it possibly shouldn't have done.
That's absolutely right. When Artemis 1 came in the uncrewed test flight, they showed sort of damage to that heat shield that they hadn't been expecting. And there wasn't really time. They had to make a decision. There wasn't really time to completely redesign the heat shield. So they just changed the profile of the reentry, how hard it came through the atmosphere. But that meant that last night in that 6 minutes of signal blackout, there was some real... I mean, I was sitting there just waiting for the return of signal because, it was a proper breath-hold moment last night and wonderful to see them come through it.
Right. And people are now breathing, including them. And what next?
So this is just the first step. This is the first step in a much wider program of exploration. And we're going to go back to the moon. We're not just going to go as we did 50 years ago to plant flags and wander around. We're going to set bases up. There's going to be an incredible program of science. But this team have led the way. You know, this is a beachhead moment in a new program of exploration. And I think it gives us our confidence back again for what we can do when we're working at our best and what we can do together.
Is the competition with China something that is a positive in as much as it spurs spending and enthusiasm, et cetera, et cetera? Or might it become a distraction?
Well, I think you need the right amount of healthy competition is always good. It always drives you to be better. And yes, there are shades of sort of the imperialism that we saw in the past coming in here. There is something of a new space race. We're not entirely sure what the Chinese are doing. But you know what? That might just help us forwards. You have to have some incentive to do this. And this is what exploration is always like. There's a bit of imperialism. There's a bit of discovery. There's just a bit of pure inspiration. We've got all of that this last few days.
And on the subject of inspiration, I mean, I was young when we first went to the moon. And it was, people wanted to be astronauts. Youngsters wanted to be astronauts. There was a sort of a huge amount of enthusiasm. You talk to people who've been to space and they say one of the things that got them involved was this kind of sense of, goodness, this is an option. Does that change things now for a new generation?
Well, I think so. And I think you've seen the response to this mission, haven't you? I wondered whether or not it would just, you know, go past us like water under a bridge.
Yes.
But actually, you've seen how people have responded to this. And when people ask us what we get from these programs, we get the inspiration of a new generation of people, scientists, technologists, engineers and mathematicians who are going to drive the future forwards. It did it for me. I mean, I grew up in the afterglow of Project Apollo. It was what's led me into science. It what's led me into my career as a doctor. And it will do so for another generation now. And that's a wonderful thing. And you've got to celebrate that.
And the thought of Mars, too. I mean, Donald Trump's been talking about going there. And I mean, even if you put that to one side and focus on those who might have a more realistic chance of making it happen, it is at least in the conversation, isn't it? Which is extraordinary.
It is absolutely in the conversation. I think we'll do the moon first. And there's been a long debate about whether or not you should go back to the moon or just go straight for Mars. But we'll go to the moon in the way that, you know, I learned how to do camping, which is you take a tent out into your parents' back garden, you work out what you need next time before you put it on the side of K2 or whatever. And so the moon will be that for us. It will help us, you know, sort of flesh out our exploration and expedition class missions. You know, this is a really wonderful moment. This is about to be the most exciting era in human spaceflight we have seen for over half a century. And what a beginning this has been.
Kevin Fong, as ever, thank you.
It's just gone 10 to 8 and it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Reverend Roy Jenkins, Baptist minister in Cardiff.
Good morning. As this programme frequently affirms, it's a turbulent, dangerous world. Wars rage, thousands are killed, many more maimed or displaced. And economic forecasts don't seem to cheer up anybody, even when they're already comfortable, very comfortable. Easter week formally ends today. After last weekend's celebration of resurrection, new life and high hopes, some churches tomorrow will be marking Low Sunday, a title with a variety of explanations but an unavoidable ring of anti-climax. Right now you've had your high, the excitement's over, get on with real life. But what if real life is overshadowed by some cloud of anxiety you can't control? 40 years ago this month, a reactor exploded at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine, which then belonged to the Soviet Union. Radioactive fallout spread across Europe, and though there'd been relatively few direct casualties, there was widespread concern about the future contamination. No one could know. 3 weeks after that explosion, I was part of a long-range delegation to churches across Russia and some other parts of the Soviet Empire. I've no idea whether the people we met knew any more about potential harms than we did, but I don't recall hearing of any. What I've never forgotten was their worship. It was still Easter there, and in every service of whatever tradition, packed congregations would respond enthusiastically to the proclamation, "Christ is risen," with the words, "He is risen indeed." And always they sang with fervour. One Orthodox celebration I compared with standing between two of the best male voice choirs in Wales and the chorus of Welsh National Opera in the gallery. The Baptists offered passion in hymns that I knew from home. All of them, however, were people facing not the unknown perils of a cloud of radiation, but all too familiar threats for the subversive activities of distributing Bibles, teaching young people, or running a Sunday school. They could lose their liberty, their homes, or their jobs, but still they proclaimed, "Christ is risen." It was deeply humbling. Words and music together can help in the battles with all kinds of clouds. They just need to be capable of lifting spirits, calming, challenging. Misha Glennie's guests on In Our Time this week talked about some of the ways that that could happen through Handel's immensely popular oratorio, Messiah, a religious work for sure, focusing on Jesus, but embraced by people of all faiths and none. It deals with joy and suffering, with death and eternal hope. I loved the suggestion that its haunting opening words, "Comfort ye my people," is a call to go out and do the comforting, not to feel comforting. Bit disturbing, though.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Roy Jenkins. It brings us to 7 minutes to eight.
The current plan for the UK to hand sovereignty of the Indian Ocean Chagos Islands to Mauritius has been shelved after failing to get the necessary approval from the United States. One of those islands, Diego Garcia, is home to a UK and US military base. The government's plan had been to hand over that sovereignty, have a lease agreement to continue the base there, something that was criticised by some politicians here because of potential costs the links Mauritius has with China. It had been backed by Donald Trump's administration until this year, when President Trump criticised the plan while expressing his desire to acquire Greenland, if you remember. UK government officials now say the plan hasn't been entirely abandoned, but there's no time to make it law this Parliament. It's not expected to be in the King's Speech in May that lays out plans for the next Parliament. Lord MacDonald joins us now, who's former senior diplomat at the Foreign Office and was in charge there when the UK was advised to hand over the islands. Good morning to you. What's your reaction to this?
The government had no other choice. The UK had two objectives. One was to comply with international law. The second was to reinforce the relationship with the United States. When the President of the United States is openly hostile, the government has to rethink. So this agreement, this treaty, will go into the deep freeze for the time being.
Given where we've got to, you might say the government had no other choice. But did it have other choices along the way that could have meant it could have carried out the plans it wanted to?
I mean, there were choices over many decades, but as soon as this went into the International Court of Justice, as soon as the UK had agreed to that process, we were bound by the outcome of that process. And everything that has happened now, and also, remember, under the Conservative government before the Labour government, is a consequence of that ICJ judgment.
Is there a mood at the minute amongst some countries around the world to perhaps disregard international law more than in previous times? And perhaps the UK should have pushed that thought a little bit more?
There is a mood to disregard international law. It is being led by the United States. Russia, China have always been a bit ambivalent, but the US being equally ambivalent is noticed by everybody. The UK has always defined itself as a country which respects, upholds international law. I think the government is correct to keep to that traditional policy.
What does it mean now for the UK and its relationship with the Chagos Islands, how we can use them, how long we can use them for?
There will be no change. The Mauritians are in no place to take them over, to force a transfer. I don't think they'll even try. Mauritius is over 1,200 nautical miles from the Chagos archipelago. It doesn't have any navy to speak of. So I think the status quo will persist.
So if the status quo is persisting, how did this become such a big controversial deal that had such a role in the UK's relationship with the United States?
Because this was an issue that was a hangover from the end of the colonial era. For the last 200 plus years, successive powers that controlled the Indian Ocean administered it as one unit. So at independence, the rules of decolonization were that the whole unit should become independent as one new country. The Brits, to help the United States, carved out the Chagos Archipelago to allow the Americans to build this absolutely vital base at Diego Garcia. The Mauritians were never happy about that. The whole process took more than half a century. It's going to take even longer to sort out now.
So what should the next steps be? If we're thinking it's not going to be in the King's Speech and a plan for the next Parliament, should the UK be spending time and energy trying to persuade Donald Trump and his administration otherwise?
I think that will happen in a low-key way. The president has already changed his mind more than once on this issue. So it is possible he'll change his mind again. If he doesn't, then there'll be a new president in 2029.
Lord MacDonald, former senior diplomat at the Foreign Office, thank you for your time this morning. It's not far off a minute to nine, so let's get minute to eight, the weather forecast for the morning. Simon King at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Simon.
Hi, Sean. Good morning. Yeah, it's quite a wet and windy start to the day for some of us. We've got some rain that's moving its way eastward today. So across southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, still some of that rain around at the moment. It's going to move fairly quickly eastward and then there'll be some sunny spells developing before the cloud thickens up from the west. And with that, there'll be some showers, especially for Wales, the Midlands, northwest England, where there could be heavy, even thundery. Some strong winds to go with that as well. Gusts potentially up to about 60 miles an hour during the south. Afternoon and maximum temperatures of 7 to 11 degrees. For southeast, eastern and northeast areas of England, mostly dry this morning, quite cloudy, but we'll see some patchy rain moving its way in as we go through the next few hours. The rain will eventually clear away to the east by lunchtime and then the cloud will break up. There'll be some sunshine developing, but again, there'll be some afternoon showers working their way in from the west, more so I think in northeast England, and temperatures of 11 to 14 Celsius. Now for North Ireland, some sunny spells this morning, but already though the cloud thickening in the west with some showery outbreaks of rain here and showers on and off really throughout the day. Blustery conditions, 9 to 10 degrees and pretty wet across Scotland. That rain clears away to the east. Sunny spells and blustery showers into this afternoon, 7 to 10 Celsius.
Thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 11th of April. The headlines this morning.
Splashdown confirmed.
Copy splashdown, waiting on VLDR.
From the pages of Jules Verne to a modern-day mission to the moon, a new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete. Integrity's astronauts, back on Earth.
After an historic voyage to the far side of the moon, the crew of NASA's Artemis mission has returned safely to Earth. The most high-level talks in decades between Iran and the US are due to get underway to try to end their war, and the deal to hand over sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius is being shelved.
And after the news, we'll hear from the first British astronaut who undertook that 24,000 miles an hour plunge back to planet Earth.
The re-entry is the biggest ride of the whole mission. It's the most physically demanding. All that energy that was put in with that enormous rocket at the beginning during the launch has to come out in order for us to slow down sufficiently.
I'm Natalie Perks with your Saturday Sport. Rory McIlroy is looking good in his quest to retain the Masters. He's reached 12 under at Augusta, a record 6-shot lead at the halfway stage. And we're building up to the biggest day in the jump racing calendar, the Grand National at Aintree.
The BBC News read this morning by Charles Carroll.
The astronauts of the Artemis II lunar mission have returned to Earth after completing the first crewed voyage to the moon in more than half a century. Their Orion capsule splashed down safely in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California after nearly 10 days in space. NASA described it as a textbook touchdown and said the crew were all in excellent shape. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, sent this report from Mission Control in Houston.
Multiple airborne assets as part of the recovery team all have visuals on Integrity. Still do not have communications from the crew.
A first glimpse of the Integrity spacecraft appearing as a fast-moving speck of light high above the ocean. Then confirmation the crew were safe.
Integrity, Houston, comm check post-blackout.
Houston, Integrity, we have you loud and clear.
They just hurtled through the atmosphere at 24,000 miles an hour, their spacecraft enduring temperatures as hot as the surface of the sun.
Splashdown confirmed at 7.07 p.m. Central Time, a modern-day mission to the moon. A new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete.
The Artemis astronauts were back on Earth, the cramped capsule that had been their home for the last 10 days bobbing on the waves. The door was opened for that first breath of fresh Earth air, and the astronauts were airlifted one by one by helicopter to the recovery ship nearby. Jared Isaacman, NASA's head, was waiting on board.
I'm still at a loss for words. I mean, you know, like the childhood Jared right now can't believe what I just saw. I mean, almost been waiting my whole lifetime to see this.
The U.S. Space Agency says this is just the start. It's planning a lunar landing for 2028 and a moon base. This mission has exceeded expectations. For NASA, the millions of people who followed every step of this epic journey, and, not least of all, the astronauts themselves.
Peace talks between Iran and the United States aimed at ending their six-week conflict are due to get started shortly in Pakistan. The Iranian delegation arrived overnight, while the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, landed this morning. He's warned Iran against trying to play the US. From Islamabad, our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis reports.
After weeks of speculation, talks in Islamabad seem about to commence. The sound of Pakistani jets echoed through the city skies just after midnight as they accompanied in the Iranian arrivals. Leading their delegation is the parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, along with the foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. They were met at the airport with a red carpet and flowers. Mr. Ghalibaf shared images of seats on their plane filled with the burnt school bags and pictures of the schoolgirls killed in an airstrike on the first day of the war. The stakes are high, the gap between the two countries' positions wide. Getting both sides to Islamabad was the first hurdle. It will not be the last.
With her assessment of the significance of these talks, here's our chief international correspondent, Lise de Sette, in Islamabad.
The talks would mark the highest level meeting between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States since diplomatic relations were severed in the shadow of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In recent years, any negotiations were at a lower level and mostly indirect, a measure of Iran's deep distrust. It deepened further when the last two rounds of discussions, last year and this year, were shattered by war. Iran insisted on moving negotiations to a more senior level, and specifically to the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, who's seen as the greatest opponent of this war in President Trump's team. And Iran's delegation is now led by Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, a hardliner regarded as a pragmatist. But they both come to this table believing they're winning this war. They will make history, but it's not clear how much progress they will make. But it will send a signal of a commitment to talk. And in this moment, that matters.
The Lebanese president has said his country's representatives will meet their Israeli counterparts at the US State Department on Tuesday. Israel's ambassador in Washington has confirmed that formal peace talks will begin. The aim is to discuss the possibility of a ceasefire between Israel and the Iran-backed group Hezbollah in Lebanon. Keir Starmer has shelved plans for the UK to transfer sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the United States failed to give formal approval to the deal. Government officials have insisted that they're not entirely abandoning the agreement, but the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, said the delay in dropping the deal was another damning indictment of the Prime Minister. Our political correspondent Joe Pike has more details.
In January, President Trump called the plan an act of total weakness. He has urged Keir to scrap the deal, despite previously expressing support for the treaty. The deal would see the UK cede sovereignty of the territory to Mauritius and pay an average cost of £101 million a year to lease back a joint UK-US military base on the largest island. Ministers have run out of time to pass legislation before Parliament is dissolved in the coming weeks. A fresh Chagos bill is not expected to feature in the King's speech next month.
A ceasefire is due to begin in Ukraine this afternoon for Orthodox Easter, after Moscow and Kiev agreed to pause all fighting. President Zelensky said Ukrainians needed an Easter free from threats and called for Russia to agree to a longer-term ceasefire. The Kremlin ruled that out, saying the truce was temporary. From northeastern Ukraine, Sarah Rainsford reports.
After more than 4 years of all-out war, people here do want a pause in the fighting. Ukraine soldiers most of all, who are exhausted, but also civilians, especially in the east, where towns and villages are hit by Russian missiles and drones every day. Last month alone, the UN says at least 211 civilians were killed in Ukraine. But frontline troops we've spoken to here have low expectations of this Easter ceasefire. They see it as a show of piety by Vladimir Putin, who displays no real desire to stop the war he started, and they expect multiple violations of the ceasefire on the ground.
A 77-year-old British man has died in a bus crash in the Canary Islands. The vehicle veered off a motorway on the mountainous island of La Gomera. Here's Tom Simons.
Photographs shared by the Canary Islands government show the coach lying on its side at the bottom of a 10-metre-deep ravine, close to a tight bend in the road on the east coast of La Gomera. It was carrying 27 tourists and there was one driver. All but one on board were injured in the crash, four seriously, two of whom were taken to hospital by air ambulance. The man who died has not been named. The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said the government was in touch with local authorities and ready to support British victims of the crash and their families.
A head teachers' union is demanding the government steps in to help retired teachers who it says are waiting for thousands of pounds of delayed pension payments. The NAHT says that members who ask to receive a lump sum are not getting it on time and need help to deal with the financial problems that follow. The government says that it's working closely with the firm which runs the scheme, Capita, to address any emerging issues. Andrea Cassidy recently retired. She told Radio 4's Moneybox programme that she was yet to receive her pension.
I've paid in a lot of money to my pension. It horrifies me that they're just ignoring me. There's no communication at all. I don't know what else to do. This month, I'm not sure how I'm going to be able to pay my mortgage because I don't know if my pension will be through. I'm not a worrier, but I'm really worrying.
The Metropolitan Police says that anyone showing support for the banned group Palestine Action at a protest today is likely to be arrested. Organisers say they expect thousands of people in Trafalgar Square to hold signs reading, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action." In February, police stopped arresting demonstrators after the High Court ruled the ban on the group unlawful, but the judgment is being appealed by the Home Secretary. The US is calling on video gamers to apply for jobs as air traffic controllers to help tackle a shortage. In a new campaign, the Federal Aviation Administration says the skills needed to play games and safely direct planes are quite similar. Tom Dewsbury reports.
The FAA says gamers have, in effect, already been training to become air traffic controllers. It says people who are good at games demonstrate high cognitive functions and problem-solving skills, which are necessary for a career in a tower. The advert mixes footage from games such as Fortnite with shots of the radar screens used by controllers and says new recruits won't only keep millions of people safe, but, perhaps crucially, will make a lot of money. Last year, there were 3,000 controller vacancies and growing concern about a shortage. The US Transportation Secretary says the field has to adapt to attract the next generation.
Tom Dewsbury reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. The heat shield held up. The astronauts are back and are safe. A mission to get to the moon and back has been a resounding success. It was a nervous few minutes in the middle of last night as the craft headed for Earth. The Artemis 1 craft had come back with over 100 locations on it where chunks had been ripped off during the re-entry. NASA spent 2 years figuring out why, concluding in the end it was gas pressure building up inside the material during re-entry. They decided, though, not to replace the shield. What they did is change the flight path instead, so there was a steeper angle, less time in the danger zone. At the time, the NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman said this approach is not the right way to do things long term. And it is true that the brutality of the re-entry is extraordinary. The capsule has to slow from 25,000 miles per hour to 17 miles per hour in 13 minutes. The heat created is huge. The danger, well, pretty obvious. So trepidation as at about 10 to 1 in the morning our time, Artemis hit entry interface, meeting the top of the Earth's atmosphere. coming within a whisker of the record set by Apollo 10 back in 1969.
10 seconds till entry interface. And we have crossed the threshold, now entering the Earth's atmosphere. We're at 400,000 feet, traveling 34,800 feet per second. Time to splash down, 13 minutes, 10 seconds.
For the next 6 minutes, the blackout began. Not a single word came from the astronauts. Total radio silence. But then, a signal from the capsule.
Integrity, Houston, comm check, post-blackout.
Houston, Integrity, we have you loud and clear.
Your trajectory is nominal, and your recovery teams have visual.
Guidance looks good.
And then finally, the Pacific Ocean came into view and a safe return.
Houston, Integrity, splashdown, sending post-landing command now.
Splashdown confirmed.
Copy splashdown, waiting on VLDR.
Splashdown confirmed at 7.07 p.m. Central Time, 5.07 p.m. Pacific Time.
NASA described it as a textbook touchdown. At a news conference, NASA's Associate Administrator, Amit Kassira, was already looking ahead to future missions.
The path to the lunar surface is open, but the work ahead is greater than the work behind us. It always will be. 53 years ago, humanity left the moon. This time, we return to stay. Let us finish what they started. Let us focus on what was left undone. Let us not go to plant flags and leave, but to stay. With firmness in our purpose, with gratitude for the hands who built the machines, and with love for the ones that we carry with us. Welcome home, Integrity.
I've been talking this morning to Britain's first astronaut, to Helen Sharman, and we began with that re-entry. What does it feel like?
The re-entry is the biggest ride of the whole mission. It's the most physically demanding for the human body. As we come back through the atmosphere, of course, that decelerates the spacecraft. All that energy that was put in with that enormous rocket at the beginning during the launch has to come out in order for us to slow down sufficiently. And that energy is taken up largely as heat. So as we come through the atmosphere, the outside of the spacecraft gets hot, and therefore the layer of atmosphere around us gets really hot, so hot that bits of electrons, bits of the molecules are stripped off. It creates this ionized, this charged cloud of plasma around the spacecraft, and it glows. So you get this orange and this yellow, and then the ablative covering of the spacecraft starts to come away a little bit, and that covers the window a bit, so that darkens, but you can still see flashes. There are pockets of gas that buffet the spacecraft. And then when the atmosphere is thick enough, you get the parachutes that open, and the drogue chutes first, which bit of a jerk, and then the main chutes, and you really jerked around side to side and decelerating very quickly as soon as that that canopy opens up. So, yeah, so it's quite a bit of a sort of a ride even before you get close to the ground. And then, of course, you've got that landing, or the splashdown in the case of Artemis 2, a bit of a bump at the end.
When you say you're jerked around side to side, is it like, I don't know, turbulence on a plane or more than that? What do you look at each other while it's happening? What to describe from the inside what's going on?
So we're sitting inside our seats. So I came back to Earth in a Soyuz. So there are three of us side by side, very cozy. So arms pretty much touching. Orion spacecraft, they had a little bit more room for the four of them. They were sort of in seats of banks of two underneath the other two's legs, kind of thing. But no, we're sitting in our seats that are molded to fit our backs, so they're quite cozy. It's quite difficult to look around side to side to see your crewmates, but you can do that. But when you're decelerating so hard, you're being pushed down and back into your seat, so you really need to stay as still as possible. But this sideways jerking is quite violent. The parachutes open, and the spacecraft is sort of sideways on to a parachute to start with, until it sort of rights itself and is a little bit more coming straight down underneath the chute. But that does mean that we have probably an angle of about a good 30 degrees. So it's much more than the normal turbulence on an aeroplane. If you weren't strapped in, you would definitely fall out. In fact, we had quite a few items that we had stowed not very well that did fall out during that period, and they fell out, of course, on top of us.
Still, they're back, and they're back safely, and they've done it in this manner. What does it mean now for the immediate future?
Well, very excitingly, of course, there's a whole load of experiments that had happened while they were on board, and a load of data. And that's the big thing for a lot of the NASA scientists and engineers. So they will pore over this data, making all the refinements that are necessary, getting the information first of all, of course. And we know, for instance, there are certain problems that they had. There were helium leaks, even with this spacecraft. And once they were in space, it didn't matter, as it turned out. But the NASA's already said that's one of the things that they will have to probably do a redesign on, some of the valves where the helium was pressurizing some of the fuel for them to be able to operate their thrusters on the way back, for instance. But then, of course, the next mission will be about docking spacecraft and undocking, so that we can think about docking with a lander that will take people down onto the surface of the moon. And then in 2028, that's the schedule for the next, the following Artemis mission, Artemis 4, that will actually land humans on the surface of the moon. And that's when it starts to get, I think, particularly exciting.
Yeah, and that was something that seemed to be, I wouldn't say routine, but it seemed to be something that humans were very much involved with back in the 70s, and then we all rather gave up on it. Is the thing that powers it now, in your view, the competition between the United States and China, or is it just a sense that we need to explore these places, or getting to Mars, or what is it that can power this, and I suppose power the enthusiasm and frankly the money that will make it happen?
Yes, and there has always been, of course, the science that we want to do on the moon, the science of the moon. That's developed over the years, but that's still there. But the imperative now is this desire to get there before the Chinese get there. So there's this really strategic part of the moon, the South Pole, with water, ice, of course, but it's water there, which will be really useful, not just for astronauts to drink, but to be able to electrolyze, to breathe the oxygen, to use the hydrogen for a fuel. There's minerals there that are easily accessible. Interestingly, some really good minerals for our electronics, for instance, some rare earths, and also an amazing crater, the lip of which will give pretty much 24/7 solar radiation, so batteries can be charged, and that's a really important factor. So everybody wants to get to this strategic location of the moon. It's quite big, right? This crater's huge, but if one establishes one's operations there, and that's the way the Artemis Accords have been written, and these are a sort of set of, let's say, rules, guidelines that have been established by NASA. Many countries have signed up to them to sort of guide us into how we might operate on the moon. They state that if you've got an operation on the moon, you shouldn't interfere with somebody else's. Oh, sorry, if there is an operation on the moon, it shouldn't be interfered with by another entity, a country or a company. Notably, China and Russia have not signed up to those Artemis Accords. So there's really, it's a bit, going to be a bit of a Wild West, a grab for the best bits of the moon. So yes, so there's a race, but there's also a great lunar economy. And now with commercialization, we realize that there's money to be had. Billions of dollars in the next 20 years have been forecast to be had just because of what's the economy of lunar operations.
Helen Sharman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we can talk live now to our science editor, Rebecca Morell, who is on the line. What does Rebecca have? What does happen next, if I can get those words out?
Well, for the astronauts themselves, I mean, they are going to undergo a raft of tests. They're having medical checks right now. And tomorrow, we think, probably late Houston time in the afternoon, they're going to come back and be reunited with their families here. For NASA, though, you know, the work really continues. They're going to be studying this spacecraft. They've collected so much data from it, from launch through to its journey around the moon and landing. They're going to be studying that. The scientists here, there were lots of science experiments on board with the astronauts. The astronauts kind of became guinea pigs themselves. Science was done on them to study the effects of deep space on the human body. So they won't get much of a rest themselves, actually. They'll get to hang out with their families for a bit, and then they'll be back in the lab being studied by the scientists. So there's lots to do here. I mean, the lunar scientists, they are poring over those images that came back with the astronauts, because some of them, of course, were beamed back down here to Earth, but they've actually carried many more on the memory cards, you know, thousands of images that were taken of the far side of the moon. So, you know, it's a brief moment of celebration, but some hard work to begin. And of course, NASA want to get ready for the next Artemis mission. They've got a very ambitious timescale, you know, particularly attempting to land on the moon in 2 years' time. I mean, I would say they haven't picked their lander yet. It's not been built. So, you know, who can say whether that 2 year timeline is actually going to happen or not? But it'll be very interesting to see how they do.
But the fact is, though, that the success of this mission does mean, doesn't it, that they are going to press ahead, and that is going to remain the aim.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been a tremendous success for the US Space Agency. But I think in some ways, even they've been taken aback by how much it's sort of captured the world's imagination. I mean, it has felt like for a few brief days, the world has been transported along with these astronauts as they've travelled around the moon and back. I mean, their entire journey was really live streamed. I mean, it felt like you were really travelling along with them, and they've kind of gone from the magnificent, you know, looking out of the window and seeing these spectacular views of the Earth and the moon, to the totally mundane. You know, people were obsessing about problems with their universal waste management system, aka their very temperamental Lou. So, I mean, it's been a very interesting story to cover, because you've just had so much access to sort of life in this very, very cramped capsule. But I mean, I think particularly it's down to the personalities of the astronauts. I mean, they're very, very good communicators. So I think NASA's almost been slightly taken aback about how big this mission has become.
Rebecca Morrell, thank you.
It's just coming up to 23 minutes past eight. The US negotiating team have arrived in Islamabad in Pakistan this morning for what's been described as historic talks with representatives from Iran, the kind of meeting that hasn't happened between the two countries for decades. In Islamabad for the BBC is Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent. Lise, good morning. I mean, we've seen 70 delegates from Iran, J.D. Vance, pictures of him arriving this morning, but we don't have a lot of information about exactly what's going on today. Is that unusual?
Well, perhaps not in high stakes and high level negotiations like this. The most significant thing is that, as you say, the U.S. delegation, 70 members strong, is here, led by the U.S. vice president, and equally that the Iranian delegation arrived in the early hours of the morning after sowing doubts all day as to whether or not they would show up, still insisting that the talks couldn't go ahead unless, as they put it, their preconditions were met, and that included a ceasefire extending to Lebanon. And also then they started asking for the freezing of Iranian assets. So this morning in Islamabad, where all the venues are ready, the journalists are waiting, the venues, the security is tight. We still don't have a time for when the delegations will meet. We're assuming they will be face-to-face. That in itself is significant. Iran has insisted on talks being indirect in recent years, but I don't think J.D. Vance would fly across the world to come here if the talks weren't face-to-face. So I think very much, as with the ceasefire, as with everything else about this, that everything seems to be made up as it goes along, but at least they're here.
Well, if you've got a 10-point plan from one side and a 15-point plan from the other, do you have an idea of what might be the key thing that both sides will be looking to get out of these early stages?
I think it has to be said that both sides are coming to these talks believing that they're winning in this war. Even though President Trump continues to speak in terms of Iran accepting American demands, Iran being militarily defeated, having no choice but to come to this table, that is not the messages. It's certainly not the posture of the Iranian delegation. The very fact that they have come, the very fact that a hardliner, a pragmatist, but nonetheless a hardliner, the parliamentary speaker, has been authorized to come here to make what is a significant gesture in meeting the Americans face to face, signals that they now know They absolutely believe they have leverage. And of course, the biggest leverage of all is the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump continues to say, open it up. Iran will only open it up as long as it retains some kind of control. It has become its most important bargaining chip in this war. It also has brought its central bank governor to these talks, signaling that in order for it to make any movement on the other issues, including, of course, most importantly, the nuclear file, as well as ballistic missiles, it expects those crippling sanctions to be lifted. So while they'll make history, whether they'll make progress, it's still not clear. But what's really important is that they make a start. This will be the most significant start since President Trump pulled out of the first nuclear deal in 2018, describing it as the worst deal in history. And now he meets a country which is no longer just enriching uranium to 20%, it's now up to 60%, just below weapons grade.
Lisa Zett, thank you.
It is 26 minutes past eight. To the sport, here's Natalie.
Now, I don't want to jinx this, but things are going rather well for Rory McIlroy. He has a record 6-point lead at the halfway stage at Augusta. He reached 12 under last night after a flurry of birdies in his quest to become only the fourth man to retain the Masters. Away from golf, it's the biggest day in the jump racing calendar with the Grand National at Aintree. Five Live Sport will have all the build-up with commentary from 4 o'clock of the big race itself. So let's talk now to our racing commentator, John Hunt, who's there for us. Morning, John. It's the day, isn't it, where people who never really watch racing will all have a flutter, they'll all have a look at their tellies. What is it about this race that really captures people's imagination?
Good morning to you, Natalie. Sounds like if Rory McIlroy could contest the Grand National, he'd probably win that as well by the sounds of things. But you're right, Liverpool's just waking up here. It's a quiet start to a very, very busy day. But the city really embraces the Grand National. They seem to love it year in, year out. I was struck, Natalie, by at the track yesterday, how many young faces there were around. There were 60,000 people enjoying a really good day sport and a good day social. It was a really fun day in many, many respects. And I think, you know, the Grand National, such a traditional event, but I think the people of Liverpool still embrace it like they always have done. And I think that is largely what makes the whole event so special and so enjoyable.
Just remind us what it actually involves, because it's very much a marathon, isn't it, as far as jump racing goes?
Yes, it's the whole event's been modified over the years. Obviously, the executive at Aintree are very, very mindful of welfare and how to minimise risk at all stages. So, yeah, you're right. A few years ago, they reduced the distance of the race slightly. They, in doing so, they attempted to reduce the amount of speed that the horses carried down towards the first fence. They completely modified the fences as well, which was a real game changer, really. They were pretty, in the olden days, they were pretty solid obstacles there, but they now have much lighter plastic cores to them, the fences. So, the track doing all they can to minimize risk. And what that has achieved is a much more open race. The standard, the quality of the horses that run in the Grand National these days compared to 30 or 40 years is just on a completely different scale. We have some very, very talented horses running in the Grand National today. And as a result, that means, or has meant in the last few years, a much, much more competitive race as well. So, it's a race that's evolving all of the time, and trying to find the winner is as hard as ever.
I mean, you sort of talk about, there's so many stories, aren't there, particularly this year around. Willie Mullins looking to become just the second trainer to win the race 3 years in a row, going for the hat trick. How do you rate his chances?
Very strong again. I mean, there are 34 runners. He's got 8 of those contenders, so well over a quarter of the field. Previous winner, Aya Maximus, is trained by Willie Mullins. Grange Clare West, a horse who has undoubted ability and course form. He'll be very high on the list. And he's even got a couple of horses that don't appear to have obvious chances, namely Leckie Watson and Champ Kylie, who enter today's race seemingly having lost their form a little bit, but they were top-notch horses a year or two ago. And the spring here in Liverpool and the changing ground conditions could well bring about some revival in their fortunes as well. So I think the old adage that anything can win the Grand National still very much applies, and it would be a major surprise if Mullins doesn't have a big say as to where the ultimate destination of the winner lies.
And a lot of my female friends, John, are quite fancying Panic Attack. There's some romance there. Tell us about Dan Skelton.
Yeah, Dan Skelton is just a couple of weeks away from being crowned champion trainer for the first time. He's had an exceptional season. And his runner here, Panic Attack, she is a female horse. There aren't many female horses that contest the Grand National. She has had a most fantastic season, Natalie. It's she's achieved at such a high level all the way through the national hunt season this winter. And yeah, can she go once again and win the biggest prize of the lot? It would be a great story. Not many horses are able to maintain a high level of form right the way through from October to mid-April like she's attempting to do today. And she will carry the hopes of many, many punters today.
Well, John, thank you so much. We really hope for a thrilling but also safe race. And you can hear more from John and the team, of course, on 5 Live and BBC Sounds. We've got some tips for you. John's taken us through the runners and riders, but in the 3:05, the number 5, Home by the Lee. And at 4 o'clock in the National, we're going for number 22, Jaguar.
We'll cross that one off. Thank you, Natalie. I tell you what, Justin, I'm quite amazed you haven't squeezed in Bath's rugby success. You're clearly getting carried away with their successes.
I am so confident at every stage that they will win every match. Not.
What a comeback last night. Right, Adrian Giles joins us now with details of this morning's Saturday Live.
Well, I'm absolutely exultant at a 0-0 draw with Millwall. Imagine how that feels if that's your source of joy on a
Was that
a
you
Friday
and Millwall?
Night. That was West Brom and Millwall. And, it was... Anyway, it's a long story. So, today on Saturday Live, we've got the man who elevated practical joking to an art form, no less. That's Dom Jolly. So much to Dom. He's been a diplomat, he's a linguist, traveller, broadcaster, a writer, lots more besides celebrating the 25th anniversary of Trigger Happy TV. We've got Walter Itzolino, who's Walter, as in Channel 4's Walter Presents. A fascinating guy, watches an enormous amount of television from around the world to bring us this curated collection on Channel 4 of the world's finest foreign language drama series. And we also have a worm expert, Dr. Jacqueline Stroud, Professor of Soil Science at Warwick University. Absolutely fascinating she is, who likes nothing better than getting her ear to the ground, quite literally, and eavesdropping on worms to see what they are up to. Also, we have the actor who took us from the ER to the critically acclaimed The Pit. That's Noah Wiley. We'll have his inheritance tracks. That's Saturday Live coming up from 9.
Adrian, thank you. A look at the weather. It's going to start cloudy, rain reaching the southeast, showers in the west. Then, though, in the afternoon, some sunny spells will develop. It'll be windy in the west.
It's 8:33. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Sean Barrington and Charles Carroll with a summary of the news.
NASA says the crew of the Artemis 2 mission are in excellent shape after returning safely to Earth, having travelled beyond the far side of the moon. Their Orion capsule splashed down in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California after 9 days in space. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has arrived in Islamabad for talks with Iran aimed at ending their six-week conflict. Iran says it's ready for a deal, but only if Washington recognises its rights. President Trump has said the Strait of Hormuz will be opened up with or without the Iranians. Lebanese officials say their country's representatives will meet their Israeli counterparts at the US State Department on Tuesday. Israel's ambassador in Washington has confirmed that formal peace talks will begin. And Sir Keir Starmer has put on hold plans to transfer sovereignty of the Chagos Islands to Mauritius after the United States withheld formal approval. Reform UK called the move long overdue. The Lib Dems said the handling of the Chagos deal had been shambolic.
It is 8:35. We have a right to protest in this country, but there are limitations as well. And right now the barriers are being delivered. The ordinary lives of many Londoners about to be disrupted again by people who are protesting against the ban on Palestine Action, the group the government has banned under the Terrorism Act. The police say people expressing support for a banned organisation are committing an offence themselves. And they say in a statement, this is the Met, we will not hesitate to act when the law is broken. The protesters point out that the ban on Palestine Action was appealed to the High Court and overturned, but it remains in place while the Home Office appeal. Here is what Akiko Hart, director of the human rights organisation Liberty, said about the Met's statement.
The Met statement is confusing, and it's piling on confusion to what is already quite a baffling situation for many people. And I think this really demonstrates the confusion which has arisen from the prescription and the suspension of the effect of the judgment. Liberty intervened in the case because we believe that the UK's definition of terrorism is so broad and so wide-ranging that it captures behaviour that most people would not consider to be terrorism. When it's not clear what terrorism is, public trust collapses. And if public trust collapses, then counter-terror laws simply don't work, which is why we need a new definition of terrorism.
Let us talk to Dal Babu, former Chief Superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, member of the London Policing Board, though he's giving his personal views as ever here, and he's here in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning, Jeff.
Once again, the Met in a bind.
It's an extremely difficult situation. I think what's very, very clear to understand is that the legislation in terms of the ruling means that the organisation, Palestine Action, remains prescribed because although it was successfully challenged, the judgment specifically says it remains a prescribed organisation pending any appeal that the government will make. During the hearing, people came up and were supporting Palestine Action. There's a huge amount of emotion given what's happening in Gaza and now what's happening in Lebanon. But the law, as it stands at the moment, states very clearly that the group is prescribed. And what the police did previously was say that they would take a more relaxed stance on people who were supporting Palestine Action. And now they have reversed that decision and says that they will arrest.
Do you know why they've reversed it?
I think they wanted to give clear guidance to the police officers that will be dealing with this matter. This will be an operational decision, and it will be based entirely on what intelligence they have.
Because one of the criticisms of them is that actually there have been Palestine Action-linked demonstrations in other parts of the UK without arrest. So there was one in Belfast where Amnesty International's programme director for Northern Ireland says, I think it's notable on that occasion, this is last year in Belfast, Police Service Northern Ireland took a low-key approach, didn't intervene, didn't appear to have any intention of making arrests. Why not do the same thing in London?
I think we have 43 different forces. Each force has taken a different approach, and it will be based on the intelligence that they have. I think if you're looking at...
Sorry, intelligence they have in what terms? Meaning that that this might be more threatening, or what is it that would decide them to take a more robust action than another force decided not to take?
So in terms of intelligence, whether they have information around how many people are going to come out, what people intend to do, the kind of demonstration that they will do, whether it will be passive or whether it will be more robust. There's a whole range of decisions that are made operationally. So these decisions are made operationally. Certainly when I've been involved as a on public order events, which where you've got a significant amount of violence, in, whether it's football matches or demonstrations between far-right groups or far-left groups, what you end up doing is having two police officers with each person arrested. You then put them into a van, you wait until you've got four or five prisoners along with the police officers, and then you drive off to a custody suite. I think the difficulty is when you've got 700-800 people who are willing to be arrested, that just isn't practical.
And who are not violent.
No. And indeed, and I think what you saw...
In a sense, is the lack of violence, isn't it? Almost that makes it more difficult for the police.
Precisely. I think, you know, the optics of this will be very challenging for the police. You know, if you've got people in their 70s and their 80s who are showing no resistance but are not cooperating, may not want to give their names and addresses, then it makes it much more challenging for the police to deal with it. So it will present some significant difficulties for the police in terms of how they manage it, and also be aware of the fact that there'll be a huge amount number of people who will have sympathy with what's going on and the views of Palestine Action.
Do you think that there will be sympathy as well, behind the scenes at least, in the police force, for what we just heard from Akiko Hart, the director of Liberty, saying that actually there needs to be a new definition of terrorism, that defining it so widely hasn't worked, and in a sense that's what we're discovering again today?
Well, I think the High Court decision, the successful challenge, shows that there are some challenges in how the definition is defined and how it's interpreted. But that would be a matter really for how what happens in terms of the appeal that the Home Secretary will have, and indeed what will happen in terms of further debate about how we deal with that definition of terrorism.
Darrell Babu, former Chief Superintendent at the Met. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just gone 20 to 9. The Cambridge Five group of spies has long captured the imagination, inspiring John le Carré classics to the more recent Spy Among Friends TV series. But new declassified files have led to suggestions. We should think maybe a bit differently of the stories of those Cambridge graduates, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, Anthony Blunt and John Cairncross, those men recruited by the Soviet Union in the 1930s to steadily infiltrate the British state and pass on classified information. Antonia Senior is a journalist and author. On her new book, Stalin's Apostles, The Cambridge Five and the Making of the Soviet Empire, has got into these new files. Antonia joins us in the studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So for those of us who've only maybe absorbed these stories through some form of drama over the years, what have you found?
It was precisely because of those dramas that I wanted to write the book, because the dramas present these guys as kind of glamorous rogues, as sort of almost like Robin Hood figures, kind of stealing secrets off the rich to empower the poor. And what I went looking for is who were the actual victims of their treachery? And I discovered that if you turn the question on its head and say, what did Stalin want from these guys? What you get is a much more nuanced picture, because what you see is that Stalin's foreign policy agenda for the entire 17 years that these guys were feeding him all our secrets was to expand the limits of the Soviet world out beyond Russia and to kind of hold in his thrall the people of Eastern and Central Europe. And the Cambridge Five were instrumental in making that happen.
So how have you come about these new theories? What files are around now that weren't around before?
Well, it was incredibly exciting, to be honest. So the MI5 itself has released tens of thousands of pages of documents about the Cambridge Five in the last 5 years, all the MI5 investigations and all these things. And also I thought that because I wanted to write a book that took us beyond the very Anglo-centric way that we told the story in the past, I went out into other archives. So I looked in the archives of Albania and the archives of Lithuania. And I found the kind of secret police reports from the other side of the story, because from 1944 onwards, Kim Philby was betraying every single mission that we were sending, us and the Americans, we were sending men across the Iron Curtain to try and get eyes behind the Iron Curtain on Stalin. And Philby betrayed all of those missions. And for the first time, really, now that those archives are beginning to open up, the Albanian secret police archives only really opened at all a few years ago. And I think I'm one of the first Western writers to really use them. We can see the other side of the coin. We can see the kind of suffering on the ground when all these missions were betrayed.
So what kind of little nuggets are in there that make you come to conclusions that the drama we're so used to isn't quite right?
Well, one of the things that Kim Philby did was he betrayed all these operations, as I said, but he would just give the names of the men being parachuted into Albania. All he needed to do was give them the names. Because what the British and Americans did was send people back to the parts of Albania where they came from, where their family and friends were embedded. And what you can see when you go to the other side of the files is that the Albanians know exactly who's being trained by the British. They know where their family and friends are. They round them up. They terrorize them. They prepare the ground. Because if those parachutes, the parachutes land and they miss the drop, they can then terrorize all the friends and families into giving these guys up straight away. And almost all of these guys ended up basically either being killed outright or turned into kind of puppets in a play that the Albanian secret police and the other secret polices across Eastern Europe played with the British. They pretended to be genuine partisans, radioing back to British and American intelligence saying, send more men, send more arms, and they were all fake.
What impact, what difference do you think it makes on how people view these men in particular? Is there an impact on a recruitment or attitude towards intelligence services if actually there's not the romanticism around it that many have experienced?
Well, I'd quite like it if there was less romanticism about the idea of betraying your country for another country. There is One of the reasons why this story continues to entrance is because there is an inherent glamour in the entire world, and you can't escape that. I think it is quite good to have a corrective to the idea that these men were ideological heroes who were serving a regime that they couldn't really understand and were doing something that was quite noble. They weren't. They were terrible men who did terrible things, who betrayed everybody who loved them and the country that had nurtured them.
And it's Stalin's Apostles, the Cambridge Five and the Making of the Soviet Empire that we can keep an eye out for on bookshelves.
Look for it now. Buy it immediately.
Antonia Senior, author of that book. Thank you very much.
Quarter to nine is the time. What's actually going to happen today in Islamabad? In theory, Iran and the US are talking at a much more senior level than they have in recent times. And yet, while there are so many hurdles, the process itself is going to be tricky. Let us talk to Oliver McTernan, who's director of Forward Thinking, which is a mediation and conflict resolution organisation that deals a lot in the Middle East. And he is here in the studio. Morning.
Good morning, Jason.
Is there anything like a basis for talks? Because you assume when senior people from two sides in any conflict get together, there is some sort of a almost written, I suppose, agreement on what they're talking about. Do we have anything like that?
Unfortunately, no. As far as I understand, when they met to arrange this current ceasefire, nothing was written down. So we have the argument now whether, in fact, Lebanon was included or not included.
Right, because it seems such a major thing. Yeah. Does Israel have to stop its action in Lebanon or does it not? Ongoing discussion about it, and you're saying that is because it just wasn't clear from the beginning.
It wasn't clear, and we're in a new era where negotiations take a few hours, not several days, and as I say, nothing is actually written and agreed upon, and you know, you have a running commentary too, which actually distracts the essence of the dialogue and the negotiation.
So, do they meet in the same room? Do they meet separately and someone shuttle between them? How do they organise today?
Well, ideally, people should meet in the same room. It's like, you know, if you were interviewing me on the phone, it's quite different from us sitting opposite each other, because you read faces, you read eyes, you can sense if someone is understanding or not understanding. I think it's impossible to have negotiations where you have someone shuttling between each other. Now, we don't know as yet whether they will actually meet face to face, but I think you've got an enormous cultural challenge. I mean, deep in the Iranian culture is the importance of dignity and preserving one's dignity and avoiding humiliation. And that is even strengthened by the Shia belief that, you know, far more important than food or even life itself is to maintain your dignity. So we're meeting that with an American sort of almost pressure. I think the words of Trump when he said the only reason the negotiators, the Iranian negotiators, are alive today is to negotiate. Now, that doesn't create, I would say, the sort of atmosphere that's needed to gain success.
And yet, in sending J.D. Vance, he's sending someone who plainly doesn't want this war to continue, to put it mildly, probably didn't approve of it in the first place. And I wonder if that has its own impact on the negotiation.
Well, I think, Justin, what we can hope for best is we get a continuation of the ceasefire, but to have really a serious plan that can be agreed upon and that can solve the fundamental issues or resolve them, I think needs long-term negotiations. I recall Rob Malley saying with the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, he went to Geneva for 3 days. He was there more than 20 days. Now, I don't know if Vance is prepared for that sort of level of negotiation, that, you know, you have to take time to really address the issues. I fear we're always papering over the cracks. And of course, that is only a question of time before we get back into the cycle of violence.
And you mentioned social media at the beginning. I mean, we blame social media for all manner of modern ills, but there would be nothing wrong, would there, in theory at least, in both sides, refraining from attacking each other on social media, yeah. Although it is difficult, actually, with Donald Trump, or indeed with the Iranians, it's difficult to see that happening.
Well, you know, I think part of the problem that we don't have an unspoken or unpublished thought of Donald Trump, and whatever is in his mind, he speaks or writes about. And I think that is an enormous problem because it doesn't give people the opportunity to seriously look at the issues, to really work through what can be achieved and what can't, and to give the timeline. And so it puts pressure, I think, on the people in the room and particularly on the mediators.
Oliver McTernan, we will see what happens today and indeed in the days ahead. Director of Forward Thinking, thank you.
Thanks.
It's 10 to 9 now. After almost 2 weeks of groundbreaking rocket launches, space travel, scientific experiments, bit of photography as well, a few hold-your-breath moments as the astronauts on Artemis 2 mission took off. They disappeared behind the moon for 40 minutes. Last night they went quiet for 6 minutes as they re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. So there's been a lot going on. What has it really all been about? What next as well? Was it all worth it? Let us close the programme by having a bit of a reflection on these last few days. Kevin Fong back with us, doctor and broadcaster who used to work with NASA's Human Space Flight Programme in Houston, hosted the 16 Sunsets podcast about the history of NASA's Space Shuttle programme. Kevin, hello again. And we've got Dr. Megan Christian, European Space Agency Reserve Astronaut, also the UK Space Agency's Exploration Commercialisation Lead. That might be a key word in the space industry that we hear more about in the coming years. Dr. Christian, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So what was it in these last couple of weeks? You're an astronaut yourself, that you have really sort of absorbed the most?
So many moments. I mean, I was just glued to the live stream watching the launch and the re-entry. But I think there were some really emotional moments that captured everybody's attention. I think things like naming the craters on the moon after the capsule integrity, but also after Commander Reed's late wife. That was a really emotional moment, and seeing how the crew bonded together over that. Then, of course, the spectacular imagery from the flyby. Those photos that, you know, of the far side of the moon that we've just not had anything of the like before, especially during the eclipse. And then how excited the geologists got about the observations that the astronauts were making. And of course, this meticulous re-entry overnight.
And you're speaking like one of us lay people, never mind somebody who may well be doing something like this themselves in the coming year. So with your astronaut's hat on, what really were you, it might be something boring to the rest of us, but you were thinking this needs to work, or this maybe surprised you that changes how the rest of your career might be?
I think the part that I was probably most nervous about was the re-entry, because there had been issues with the heat shield during Artemis 1, the uncrewed test flight, and so it had to go right this time. You know, I was confident because I knew that NASA had changed the re-entry profile to make it something that wasn't going to have the same problems as last time, but still everything had to go right. So that was definitely the part that I was nervous about. But I think all the demonstrations that they did, the piloting of the capsule manually, these are all leading towards the future Artemis missions and getting us ready to go back to the moon and have a permanent human presence there.
Kevin, how different now will the next decade or two of space exploration and travel be because of this specific mission?
Oh, look, I think this is the starting gun on what is going to be the most exciting era of human space exploration we've seen for half a century. And don't get me wrong, space station, space shuttle, Mir, all of that, really impressive. But this is something new. This is us going back to the moon and not just planting flags and walking around. This is us setting up bases, hopefully, in the next few years and doing proper programs of scientific exploration and geology up there and discovering stuff that we don't even know what we're going to find up there.
And Megan, Europeans had a fair bit to do with this particular mission themselves.
Yes, absolutely. So the European Service Module, which was providing all the power and propulsion as well as the life support systems for the crew, was, of course, provided by the European Space Agency. So it's really a partnership, an international partnership, unlike the Apollo era where it was only the US. This time it's US-led, but it's international. And Europe is going to have a growing role in the next Artemis missions.
And in terms of missions maybe away from Artemis, Megan, I know you've got your exploration commercialisation hat that you can wear for the UK Space Agency as well. Are we going to be pushing to tourism to Mars? Is that going to be something that the technology that comes out of this leads to something in our lifetimes?
I think tourism to Mars is a long way off. I think that the most important thing now is to really learn how to live and work in those environments. So how to live and work on the moon so that we can implement that in Mars, on Mars in the future. Tourism, you know, out to low Earth orbit, suborbital space flights, that is becoming more and more common. But it will follow quite a long way behind the really cutting edge research and development that we need to do in the meantime.
Kevin, something that jumped out at me in the couple of weeks while covering this, when I was looking at the business news as others were looking at pictures of the Earth from the moon, was SpaceX, Elon Musk, and the size of this space industry and how much it could be worth. That is something different, isn't it? From the reflections you've had of the decades gone by, that the corporate world is so big in space now.
Yeah, but although in terms of, you know, uncrewed missions, so remote sensing and satellite and communications technology, it always has been a big player and has returned an awful lot to the exchequer's purse in this country, certainly. So yes, this is a shot in the arm for the whole industry. And you saw shares in a number of aerospace companies jump on the back of the optimism that this mission has given them. Look, this is good for everybody. It's good for business. It's going to be good for science, technology and engineering and mathematics. It's going to be good for exploration, and it's going to be good for the next generation of people, of children that we bring forwards to prosecute these programs of exploration.
What's the next launch we need to keep an eye out for, Megan?
Well, there are many to come. Of course, we're going to have a launch, our very own launch from UK soil coming soon. There's no date for it yet, but it will be most likely this year. That's not something huge like an Artemis mission, but it will be the first time that we have a launch from the UK.
Dr. Megan Christian, Kevin Fong, thank you so much for your time.
Well, let us end the programme by marking that mission and its successful return. That is all from us, our editors today. Well, Jack Evans and Tom Smith are. The studio director was Nicola Bruff. We will leave you then with highlights from the Artemis mission and those 11 days that took humanity to the far side of the moon.
The rocket is on its own. Four brave explorers ready to ride the most powerful rocket NASA has ever launched. 10, 9, 8, 7. RS-25 engines lit. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage.
The views, we've got two moon rises that we've had so far, and the views of planet Earth. We've circled it completely, and we forgot how beautiful it is to look down on Earth. And if you want to find this one, you look at Glushko, and it's just to the northwest of that, and it's a bright spot on the moon. And we would like to call it Carol, the mother of Katie and Ellie. And you spell that C-A-R-R-O-L-L. Yeah, from the cabin of Integrity here, as we surpass the furthest distance humans have ever traveled from planet Earth. But we most importantly choose this moment to challenge this generation and in the next to make sure this record is not long lived.
Houston copies. We'll see you on the other side.
Houston, Integrity, comm check.
Integrity, we have you loud and clear. Tell me.
Houston, we have you the same, and it is so great to hear from Earth again.
I will miss this camaraderie. I will miss being this close with this many people and having a common purpose, a common mission, getting to work on it hard at hard every day.
Houston Integrity, splashdown, sending post-landing command now.
Splashdown confirmed.
Copy splashdown, waiting on VLDR.
Splashdown confirmed at 7.07 p.m. Central Time, 5.07 p.m. Pacific Time. From the pages of Jules Verne to a modern-day mission to the moon, a new chapter of the exploration of our celestial neighbor is complete. Integrity.